Let's call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:30 p.m. on Monday, March 28, 2016. Present, we have Representative Wilson, Representative Pruitt, Representative Kawasaki, Vice Chair Representative Sadler, myself, Co-Chair Representative Thompson, and Co-Chair Newman, Representative Guttenberg, Representative Gaddis, Representative Edgman, and Representative Munoz. Okay, before we start, please make sure your cell phones are turned off and no electronic or devices are allowed to be utilized in committee. On today's schedule, we will continue with Senate Bill 74, Medicaid Reform, Telemedicine, Drug Database, sponsored by Senator Kelly. Today's topic will be Behavioral Health and Federal Overview, Waivers and Options. Heather Shattuck from Senator Kelly's office will give us an overview of the sections of the bill that deal with those issues. Ms. Shattuck, come to the table, place yourself on the record, and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Thompson. For the record, Heather Shattuck, staff to Senator Pete Kelly. I'm going to refer to the Medicaid reform topic and section reference sheet that I provided to the committee last week. Behavioral health is peppered throughout this bill and integrated as we're hoping the system will eventually be. So the sections that refer to behavioral health are Section 28, our Medicaid Reform Program. It's subsection B, which starts on page 26, line 18. And this is where it sets out that the department shall, in coordination with the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, efficiently manage a comprehensive and integrated behavioral health program that uses evidence-based, data-driven practices to achieve positive outcomes for people with mental health or substance abuse disorders and children with severe emotional disturbances. This this comprehensive plan must include the three things that are listed on lines 26 through 31, and that is a plan for providing a continuum of community-based services to address housing, employment, criminal justice, and other relevant issues.
We've been joined by Representative Guerra, and I wanted to note that Commissioner Davidson is also in the room. Continue, please.
Sure. Number two, it must include services from a wide array of providers and disciplines, including licensed or certified mental health and primary care professionals. And number three, efforts to reduce operational barriers that fragment services, minimize administrative burdens, and reduce the effectiveness and efficiency of the program. The other sections that relate to behavioral health are Section 30, the waiver section. Subsection F is specifically an 1115 waiver for behavioral health. And again, all of Section 30 are waivers, and that is one of the topics that the department will discuss. In Section 31 in the ER project, it's on page 31, it's A1, and that includes a referral 96 hours after somebody comes into the ER to either a primary care or a behavioral health provider. In the coordinated care project on page 32, again, we list behavioral health as one of the options in that program. And the other two big pieces related to behavioral health are sections 33 and 34. Those are on page 35. Both of those sections together remove the current requirement that a clinic service or rehabilitative services, so those are our community mental health clinics and our community drug and alcohol treatment centers, must receive a grant from the Division of Behavioral Health in order to bill Medicaid. This is a very old requirement, so this would do away with that. In that way, that would open up who can bill Medicaid to a wider array of providers, and the department can answer specific questions on that. But those provisions were in response to a federal requirement to remove those requirements for providers to receive, again, grants from the Division of Behavioral Health. So the other sections, again, on waivers is Section 30. Like I mentioned, those are the 1915 I and K options, the 1945 health homes options, and the 1115 waivers. We did provide a document from the department that breaks down some of the basics of what those waivers are. And again, that will be addressed by one of the speakers. The other section that relates to waivers is Section 41, and that's in the Medicaid State Plan waivers, instructions, and notice to the revisor of statutes. That is on page 39. And finally, the final section today that will be addressed is Section 38, which is implementing the federal policy on tribal Medicaid reimbursement. And that adds in some things that the budget subcommittees on the Department of Health and Social Services addressed, and we also put that in this bill.
You have a list there so you could repeat for the members exactly what sections we are again. Do you have that just kind of listed out where you can just say section 29, 30, 31, 38, 40?
Sure. So again, and this is the topic and section reference list that I provided. So for behavioral health, it's sections 28, 30, 31, 33, and 34. For waivers, it is section 30 and 41. And for the federal rule change, it's section 38.
All right. Thank you. And I think we're going to move right into the presentations, if that's all right with everybody. Thank you, Ms. Shattuck. We will begin with the behavioral health portion of the bill, and we have several people who are here to testify on behavioral health. First up to testify on the behavioral health section is Mr. Charlie Curry, who is the CEO of Curry Group, and Mr. Jeff Jesse, who is the CEO of Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. Mr. Jesse is present in the room, and Mr. Curry is online. Mr. Jesse, please come to the table to run the PowerPoint for Mr. Curry's testimony. First, we will hear from Mr. Curry, so please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony, and I'm going to ask that we hold questions till the end because we have so much material. Make a note of your questions so we can cover them after each presentation. Mr. Jesse.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Jesse. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. I want to move right into introducing Charlie Curie. In just a moment, I wanted to give a brief sort of context for this. Of course, the trust beneficiaries include more than people with behavioral health problems. So when we look at Medicaid reform, we're also interested in people with intellectual disabilities, people with Alzheimer's, other conditions. But behavioral health is clearly one of the key elements of any successful reform of our Medicaid system. Particularly the need to move away from the fee-for-service system into a value-based system where we're actually paying for outcomes rather than activities. The trust, as you will hear more about tomorrow when we discuss fiscal notes, has made a substantial investment in assisting you with Medicaid reform. In addition, we have retained the services of Charlie Curie, who you'll hear from in just a second, to assist us and the department in really using his expertise and background in order to make sure that we are effective in making the transformation of the behavioral health system that's essential for the state of Alaska and our beneficiaries. Very briefly, and I think Mr. Curie will go through his background in more detail. Mr. Curie was the director of the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration for the federal government during the Bush administration. He took a particular interest in Alaska, which is gratifying for a federal official to have such a real interest in Alaska. He traveled extensively in rural Alaska, so he knows the state pretty well. Since his leaving the federal service, he's been a consultant nationwide, has consulted with many states that have undergone the same types of efforts that we are here today. So we are very pleased to be able to have him under a long-term contract in order to assist with this effort. And with that, Charlie, are you on the line?
I am on the line. Can you hear me?
Yes. Please place yourself on the record, and we'll start the slideshow in your presentation.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you, Jeff, for that introduction. Just in terms of a little bit more background, as Jeff indicated, I did take a particular interest in Alaska. It was clear to me that the needs in Alaska were great in the behavioral health arena when it came to when it comes to Alaska being a frontier state. I visited many, virtually every corner of the state, both meeting with Alaska Native organizations and that becoming acquainted with the healthcare system as well as the overall community-based healthcare system that is working in Alaska. And prior to being administrator of SAMHSA, as Jeff indicated, and again, that's when I became acquainted with Alaska, I did have experience as deputy secretary for mental health and substance abuse services in the state of Pennsylvania under Governor Ridge. And it was during that period of time we implemented a behavioral health managed care program, Medicaid program, which to this day, it's approaching 20 years at this point, is how they're implementing those services. So I'll be utilizing that experience as well as the other experiences Jeff described in terms of the consultation I've done in other states to inform this process. But Alaska is clearly a unique state, frontier state, a large Alaska Native population, has specific challenges. And again, I commend the House and the Senate for taking up this matter of how to move the system ahead. I also give credit to the administration and the Department of Health and Social Services and DBH for making this a priority as well. In terms of moving to the formal presentation and the slides, and Jeff, I understand your finger's on the button there. So,
Mr. Curry,
if we can go to the first slide,
if you would
please frame the issue up of trends in public behavioral health. Alaska is not alone in facing.
Charlie, hang on a second.
Yeah, if you place yourself on the record for our recorder and the people listening, I'd appreciate it so that we have you officially as to who you are. Go right ahead.
Okay, I'm Charles Curry, principal of the Curry Group. LLC, based in the state of Maryland, just outside of Washington, D.C.
Continue.
In terms of the first slide, Jeff, is that up at this point?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Trends in public behavioral health. States are facing intractable challenges, and Alaska is not alone in that. We see virtually in every state the opioid epidemic is being identified by public officials, and both governors and state legislators have prioritized this issue consistently, needing to be addressed in a multifaceted way, both in terms of pain prescription medication, which is has contributed to the heroin crisis that we've seen ultimately. So there are preventative measures, but also what's very critical in states is to ensure that there's access to treatment and care, and that is, of course, the focus of this legislation. Congress has also identified this as an issue. Also, there's issues with medication-assisted treatment, which we need medications such as methadone, Suboxone for treatment, but also there has been a diversion of those medications that have contributed to the problem. We also have medications available today that are non-addictive and are opioid blockers, which need to be considered. But this all points to the need for evidence-based solutions and access to the latest science that's now available. Next slide, please, Jeff. Also, what has brought behavioral health to the forefront, there have been, unfortunately, high-profile mental health-related violent incidents in the country that have been related to individuals who have had untreated mental illness, which points to the need in communities to be looking at pathways to appropriate assessment, crisis stabilization, training of frontline workers, members of the police force, those who first encounter these situations, and a well-defined pathway to crisis stabilization in communities where people can receive the appropriate medications and supports to stabilize them. Also, there's a continued evolvement in overall healthcare reform in looking at prevention and wellness and to look at what is preventing cost savings. And, of course, we see obesity, diabetes, risk for heart disease, and unfortunately, people with serious mental illnesses, people with addictive disorders, have a higher rate of these disorders, and when it's a comorbid situation or co-occurring situation with these disorders, when combined with a behavioral health disorder, it's even more, not only more expensive, but also more detrimental and life-threatening to the individual. And also, there's an overall focus shift changing within healthcare, shifting to health behavior change. So that that is a part of another behavioral health connection in terms of overall health care. Next slide, please. Trends in public behavioral health include technological advances. And if we are looking, and in the bill that was just reviewed earlier that you're considering today, they talk about the use of evidence-based practices, the use of data to inform decision-making, and with the technological advances we have, we need to be looking at capacity for electronic health records, EHR, that are also clinically driven, that make sense to the clinician using them, that make sense to the consumer, who the record's about. It also can facilitate integrated care, which I'll talk about in a moment, as well as efficient data collection. Also, this is required within the Affordable Care Act and as people look at Medicaid. But one thing I would point out is that even when I was with the Bush administration, these were priorities in looking ahead to the future of what was needed in terms of health care. So regardless of ACA or not, these are the types of things that need to be in place in a transformed system of care that has greater accountability. Next slide, please. Why integrated care? Well, the burden of behavioral health disorders is great. There's much data out there in terms of the cost of untreated mental health disorders and addiction disorders. And in an integrated system of care to address both the behavioral and physical health care together, again, the data has shown us in those models that we've seen where it's been done successfully, we see cost reduced. We see the more expensive interventions of emergency room and inpatient care being utilized less if the right treatment is given in the right way at the right time. Behavioral and physical health issues are truly interwoven. What we have found is people with serious mental illness are more at risk to diabetes and other life-threatening disorders, due in part to medications they've taken, due in part to the challenges of someone with a mental illness, for example, or an addictive disorder. It's much more challenging for them to lead a healthier lifestyle. The treatment gap in the behavioral health disorders is large. In addictions alone, it's projected on a consistent basis that there are over 22 million Americans with an addictive disorder at any one point in time, and yet less than 2 million in any one year receive treatment. We also see that primary care and behavioral health settings does enhance access to primary care for people with serious mental illnesses. In other words, instead of a siloed approach where people may come to a mental health center or a drug and alcohol clinic and receive treatment for those disorders, being able to address those physical care issues and primary care issues in that setting greatly enhances care. Also, we find that providing mental health and substance abuse services in primary care settings reduces stigma. Next slide. Treating common behavioral health care disorders in primary cost settings, we have found, is also cost effective. We are able to treat depression today. We are able to screen for depression. We're able to screen for substance use. One area in Alaska where you were truly leaders is while I was at SAMHSA, we implemented screening and brief intervention and referral to a treatment. ESPERT is the name of the program, and one of the pilot sites for the nation was with South Central Foundation and Cook Inlet Tribal Council working together, and it garnered much information on providing appropriate screening for drug and alcohol disorders in a primary care setting and intervening early. And we found remarkable results in terms of people no longer heading into an addiction if it's done right. And doing it in a primary care setting can be extremely helpful. Also, the majority of people with behavioral health disorders that are treated in a collaborative or integrated way and have good outcomes. And we've seen this time and time again through various models and pilots. So next slide, please. So what are the barriers to integrated care? Well, historically, behavioral health and physical health providers have operated in silos. This has occurred partly because historically, mental health and addiction services weren't easily treated in the mainstream healthcare areas and arena. The evidence base wasn't all that strong at one time in terms of what would work. Mental health systems kind of evolved out of state mental health hospitals and community-based agencies that evolved to address people who were coming out of those hospitals, address their needs. Drug and alcohol centers kind of evolved out of a recovery movement and AA 60, 70 years ago. And again, was not necessarily part of mainstream healthcare. Also, there have been challenges in terms of sharing information between behavioral health and physical health systems. There are confidentiality laws that have addressed both mental health and drug and alcohol issues. I think we understand why, because of the stigma, but also it now has interfered in this day and age in terms of treatment, sharing information, and having a truly integrated care on behalf of individuals. And also, while there have been parity laws that have passed that indicated that require that mental illnesses and addiction disorders are treated on par with physical health disorders, there are still issues as these laws are implemented across the country. Next slide, please. So what does this mean for Alaska and a vision for behavioral health reform? We need to be thinking about streamlining services, making sure that it's not unduly bureaucratic, that it's a straightforward process. We need to think about utilization control or utilization management, that there are criteria in place which assure people are reviewed and are receiving the right treatment at the right time, in the right way as well. We need to also at the same time look at grant reformation. Alaska's been based more on a program-funded grant basis, some fee-for-service, but it's not been an overall managed system, which is what you're exactly the types of thing you're examining today, especially in light of Medicaid redesign, which gives you an opportunity to reform and transform the system to put in structures of accountability and management. And that's really what this is about and what we can learn from other states that have done that. So how to achieve this vision? Next slide, please. Look at models from other states. Their MCO means Managed Care Organizations, ASOs, Administrative Services Organizations, ACOs are Accountable Care Organizations. There's also fee-for-service managed systems. There's a primary care case management systems and a range of models where we've learned a lot of lessons of what works as well as what doesn't work. The good news is that Alaska doesn't have to recreate the wheel but can benefit greatly from the experiences, both the successes and failures of other states in shaping a program that would be a unique Alaskan solution. Policy decisions need to be made based on population, system management, geographic area, what type of benefit packages, and does it make sense to move in a direction? Maybe not immediately because there's building in the system that needs to be done in Alaska, but how do you move in a direction to where you have a value-based payment system that evolves, where there could be risk or shared savings arrangements, ultimately? Also, there needs to be improved capacity at the provider level as well as at the department level with the state. It's very important that a state government, that role is determined carefully in terms of what state government should be doing, what should an entity that has expertise in managing a managed system should be doing, and what should providers be expected to do, and what should their capacity be. And then, again, we need to implement the system's changes on a perhaps even a phased-in basis as we look ahead. Next slide, please. We need to assess organizational readiness at all levels, including providers, including the state, leadership, capacity for change, assess services and outcomes. You know, what are the business and information technology capacities. Look at the clinical infrastructures and continuous quality improvement, which is what CQI is, and how those processes can be sustained at the provider level and be monitored at the contractual and state level. And at the state level, the most important, in my recommendation opinion, the most important aspect and responsibility of the state would be in contract management and the role of state government. Procuring contracts, monitoring contracts, evaluating the effectiveness of contracts, holding contractors accountable, instead of the state doing necessarily those things, the state focus on an area to do something and do it very well, and that would be in the area of contract management, most states have found. So what have states learned? It's important, and these are important standards to keep in place. Much of this has been learned in behavioral health carve-out managed care arrangements, such as I mentioned in Pennsylvania, but we've seen this in Arizona, in Iowa, in Massachusetts, in Nebraska, Colorado, a range of other states. You need to identify people with serious mental illness and kids with serious emotional disturbances, mine the data, require plans to identify people that have those particular needs. That's the most vulnerable populations, the population for which the state is most responsible. Implement ways to incent enrollment of people with serious mental illness and kids with serious emotional disturbances, and pay higher rates for more complex and chronic conditions, and understand that going in to do it right. And think of the mitigation of, again, approaches of using risk. And require acceptance in a plan regardless of severity of conditions. Next slide. Basically makes that point that's an important standard in a plan. Also, you should include a comprehensive array of services needed for people with serious mental illness and serious emotional disturbances, recovery-oriented services, psychosocial rehabilitation services are an important part of that array, not only to help assure symptoms are alleviated of mental illness, but we also know that if people are able to build a life in the community, relapse is less likely to occur, and it's important for any managed system of behavioral health services to address that holistic approach. We also need linkages to prevention, wellness, as well as using peers. And peer support's a very important part, has become a very important part of both treating mental illness as well as addictive disorders. Some other contractual standards, next slide. We need to have incentives to avoid cost shifting to each other systems, but need to have incentives where systems assume responsibility for the populations for which they are responsible. You need to have consumer choice and protection. There needs to be assertive outreach and access standards to make sure people have access to care. And network and providers should include those with a demonstrated expertise with people with serious mental illnesses and children with serious emotional disturbances. And the good news is you have in Alaska providers who have been providing services to those populations for years and do have that expertise. We also need clear standards for treatment planning, coordination that are consumer-driven. We need to have the integrated care standards in place for behavioral health and physical health. Again, consumer involvement, use of peers, and reinvestment of cost savings as an expectation. We had a feature in the Pennsylvania program where excess revenue did not go into profits of a company, but excess revenue, because of efficiencies, people being able to have savings, they could develop a reinvestment plan and invest those dollars, which were, of course, originally tax dollars, invest those dollars back into the system. Performance measures need to be a very important part of this, and here are some of the performance measures to consider. This is the last slide. Again, access is a very important performance standard. Service utilization, how are the services being used? You would want in a managed system to see ongoing less emergency room use, for example, less inpatient use, more community-based use. Quality of care would be very important, which includes outcomes in terms of people living at their highest level of independence. Physical health metrics, again, we need to, have the blood pressure, the cholesterol, the diabetes, the compliance with medications to address people's physical disorders. And, of course, the behavioral health metrics, symptomatology, depression, psychosis, as well as whether someone is not using if they have a history of addiction. With that said, and just a concluding remark, I'm pleased to say in managed systems we've been able to see great results. Pennsylvania, after the first 10 years of implementation, there was not only $4 billion worth of cost savings realized by moving toward, in that case, a capitated system ultimately, but there were increased drug and alcohol providers, increased access to care by all populations, very successful in terms of also quality of care issues. For the committee, we are giving you, making available to you a white paper which describes those outcomes from Pennsylvania more in depth to give you an idea of the success of that program. So the key is evolving a managed system, doing it in a way that helps the system grow and have the capacities to be able to be successful and have a structure of accountability that's transparent to all parties, including the legislature, but including the public at large, as to how the system works and how it can be accessed. Thank you.
Questions from committee. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the testimony. So I think I heard you say this, but I just want to verify. So did Pennsylvania see their savings because they did a contractual versus having – whatever their department was to handle this type of new program?
Yes. Representative Wilson, indeed, the reason the savings was realized is we moved to a managed system from what was a fee-for-service, just purely a fee-for-service system that had no utilization management or utilization review in that process. So the projected savings was based on if those same services were being provided under the old unmanaged system on a fee-for-service basis compared to the managed system, it was projected over that 10-year period that there were $4 billion of savings realized.
Follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
Okay, again, maybe I'm just asking for a yes or no, but contractual to me is a private contract, an RFP going out to someone who's done this management before versus a department.
Then the answer is yes. That was indeed a part of this. We utilized expertise, behavioral health, managed care organizations were utilized in the process throughout Pennsylvania, as well as in Philadelphia. They developed their own managed entity. But there are administrative services organizations out there. You don't have to move. In fact, it's wise perhaps initially to move more to an ASO model. It doesn't have to involve capitation, but still to your point, yes, contracting with an entity that has expertise in the area was, I believe, an essential element.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got three brief questions, I hope, for Mr. Curry. Sir, thank you for bringing your expertise and your interest to bear on Alaska's problems. You offer a fairly comprehensive behavioral health transformation system. Seems to be a lot more involved in what you're proposing than what is in SB 74, the legislation before us. So how much of this bill accomplishes the transformation you described here?
I think it does very well in accomplishing it in that it gives the foundational basis that the state would need to begin to pursue having that managed system that I discussed. The 1115 waivers, for example, will be a great pathway. So the elements are in place in that bill for what I've discussed today for that process to be implemented and begin.
Thank you. Second question to the Chair. Relating to your slide number 10, what's your assessment of how ready the Department of Health and Social Services, specifically Behavioral Services Division, how ready are they for this evolution? Is there additional resources, staffing, reorganization that would be necessary to get the benefits of this transformation?
Yes. Not having done an in-depth assessment, so I wouldn't say that I'm qualified with an in-depth assessment on that. I think in discussions with people in the Department of Health and Social Services and DBH, I think it's recognized that, yes, there would need to be some reorganization for sure, a real focus on assessing the contractual management capacities, and some things that are being done now in terms of review that they're doing, for example, in certain areas, would be done under a new system in all probability with an administrative services organization. So there'd be some things that they're doing now that they wouldn't be doing directly, but the key would be having the procurement, the management oversight, the ongoing implementation of contract management and accountability in place with those contractors, and that would be a key. So there would need to be some changes take place.
Thank you. And last question, real briefly, sir, through the chair. Through the chair, if you could just rank the top three or five most prevalent behavioral health disorders that we might see in Alaska.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you would see depression and serious clinical depression. You would see and in terms of addiction, both alcohol dependent disorders as well as we are seeing in Alaska as elsewhere increase in terms of heroin. Also, you would need to prioritize in the areas of serious mental illness. Again, people making sure that people with most serious mental illness that could result in psychosis, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder as well. So I would say that those would be key essential disorders that would need to be addressed.
Thank you, Mr. Curry. Thanks, sir.
Further questions by committee? Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Curry, you've laid out a pretty comprehensive roadmap for change here, and it's appreciated. When you've gone through this in other places, where have you found the most resistant to change?
Well, that's a great question. Resistance to change many times comes out of fear, of course, in terms of what does this mean? And it has not been unusual to see consumer and advocacy groups initially be concerned that any change that takes place, they want to make sure they don't lose what they have, even though what they have may not be the best and they could do better. Just taking that step in terms of shaking things up, it's not unusual to see certain advocacy and consumer groups be concerned. Though many times they jump on the bandwagon to want to reform and transform the system once they begin to piece together what's happened in other states and what they can realize. Another group that very typical in virtually every state of providers, and I think as I'm speaking as a recovering provider, having been a provider, I know what it's like to be working in a system that even though in Pennsylvania, I was a provider in Pennsylvania 25 years ago, and it was very similar to Alaska in the sense there was some program funding, there was some fee-for-service, very little increment because of state budget issues from year after year, and we as providers, while I would say we're slowly dying in some respects, when anyone brought up a managed system, there was fear that, would we have the capacity to be able to address the standards? Would we have time to bring ourselves up to standards? And so it's not unusual to see resistance from some provider bases.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Guttenberg, follow
Thank
up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, you went to my next question, which were the providers, but the last question is three-part, and the clients. We're talking about people with mental health issues and other kind of behavioral health issues. How affected were they, and how much, change is a tough one with people having mental health issues. And did you get any feedback? Did you do feedback or from clients?
Yes. In fact, I'll turn to Pennsylvania, for example, but this is true in other states that have moved to a managed system. Consumer satisfaction has been very high. Consumers feel like they've had more choices. They've had better options and also been able to expand in a managed system. If you have a system that's relying heavily on ER, emergency rooms, very expensive and inpatient very expensive, but you can evolve a crisis stabilization which can be much less expensive, take a burden off the emergency rooms. You can then also invest and expand services which enhance access to needed care to help a person live successful in the community. You can begin to focus on housing, for example. You can begin focusing on evidence-based employment approaches to help people be gainfully employed because their symptoms are under control because they have access to the right care. So overall, consumers have rated these reform measures in states very highly and feel that they end up with a better system.
And just to follow up.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. How long did it take till all this settled out, till the confidence in the system from the providers, the agencies, and the nonprofits and the clients settled down until, because I imagine there was quite a bit of dust up and take a while to calm down and just be productive. How long does a process like that take?
Well, I think if you do, and what I see Alaska embarking upon, I think there is a process which does make a lot of sense, and I've seen work before. If up front you engage the stakeholders, the providers, the consumers, discuss what their concerns are, demonstrate and take a look at the system being set up, once you begin implementing it, what typically happens, people begin to see improvements in that first year or two, and I can say in Pennsylvania, also when I saw this implemented in Arizona, also in Louisiana, I saw some of this firsthand. When people begin to see improvements and things were addressed that weren't able to be addressed, and again, the options of the waivers that you have in this bill will give Alaska the opportunity to address some long-standing issues, people begin to come on board because they see that things are opening up that were not able to be opened up before in terms of types of services, in terms of choices. And so in terms of any dust-up, it's been actually remarkable in most states how, whether it be initial resistance and dust-up to the idea, once it's implemented and once people are engaged and they begin to see positive outcomes occur, you begin to hear people talking about, hey, this is turning the corner within the first 1 to 2 years. You know, after 2 years, in most of these situations, things were well underway and there were a lot of positive a sense and feeling. And when people see they're going to survive and maybe even thrive, you know, the reality is much better than what maybe their anticipated concerns were.
Thank you, Mr. Chu.
Thank you. Further questions from committee? Mr. Curry, I noticed the Pennsylvania model you provided to us was dated back in 2010, which is going on 6 years old. Have they continued to have success, or with increased costs and everything, have they had an increase in cost possibly? I was just curious about where we are today.
They've continued to have success. I know that the Office of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services within their Department of Health and Human Services, they've done smaller annual evaluations each year that along the same types of measures that are in that report. And what was significant about that report is that it was a comprehensive 10-year look of the first decade, full decade of the full state. The other point I would make in Pennsylvania is that it was phased in Pennsylvania, and that's certainly another thing to think about in Alaska. You don't have to have a one-size-fits-all for the whole state, and you can begin thinking about what's going to work best and still gain economies. But to answer your question, yes, there have been evaluations, and there continues to be. In fact, the maturing of the actuarial rate-setting process has continued to keep costs contained.
Very good. I don't see any further questions from committee. Mr. Curry, thank you very much for your presentation. We appreciate you calling in today. Next,
thank
we have
you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Jesse, do you have prepared testimony?
No, Mr. Chairman. You hear from me all the time. I'll be back tomorrow.
Okay. Thank you very much for the warning. General. Next to testify on behavioral health section, I invite Mr. Forrest and Mr. Burns and Mr. Burkhart to all come up to the table. From the Department of Health and Social Services, we have Ms. Karen Forrest, who is Deputy Commissioner, and Mr. Randall Burns, who is the Division Director on Mental Health. Also, I believe that Mrs. Kate Bernhardt will be testifying. She is Executive Director of the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. Please come to the table, place yourselves on the record, and begin your testimony. And I ask that the finance members please hold off on questions until after testimony from the group is completed. Place yourself on the record and begin.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Karen Forrest. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Health and Social Services. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Also joining me at the table is Randall Burns, who's the Director for the Division of Behavioral Health, and Kate Burkhart, who will place herself on the record as well. We have just heard from Charlie Curry and Jeff Jesse regarding the need to reform behavioral health services, including some of the trends nationally in behavioral health and public health, which set the stage for change in Alaska. Charlie described a very well-articulated vision of the significant reforms in the behavioral health system, which are outlined in Senate Bill 74. What I plan to do is to walk through a couple of those major sections in order to provide an opportunity to ask questions and clarify those reform measures. First, I'd like to just mention that the Alaska Behavioral Health System assessment completed in 2015 confirms what is now common knowledge, and that is that we have a fragmented behavioral health system with significant gaps, especially in the area of substance abuse services. There are a number of barriers impeding access and impacting quality and cost. The behavioral health reform projects in Senate Bill 74 will help build out the continuum of care, leading to improved access. They will improve quality of care through integration with primary care, for example, and they will reduce barriers and administrative burdens that we've been experiencing in the behavioral health system, resulting in reduced general fund costs in future years to other state agencies, such as the Department of Corrections, the courts, the Office of Children's Services, as well as in reduction in utilization of emergency departments, which we heard Mr. Curry talk about a few minutes ago. Sections 1, 2, 6, and 7 of the bill expand and encourage the use of telehealth for behavioral health by licensed professional counselors, marital and family therapists, psychologists and psychological associates, and social workers.
If I could, Ms. Forrest. Representative Wilson?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, but I'm lost. I was following what I thought was the presentation, and now that went away. So are we just going through the bill at this point?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, yes, I want to highlight some of the sections of the bill and connect them to the articulated vision for the changes in the behavioral health system that we just heard from Charlie Curry.
So could you, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, could you tell us where we're, because I was on the presentation and it was up on the screen.
Sure.
And so where are you right now?
Sure, the presentation is for later. It's for the waivers. It wasn't for this one.
Can you talk about what section you're in the bill?
Sure. Sections 1, 2, 6, and 7, pages 2 through page 6, relate to telehealth. So sections 1, 2, 6, and 7 expand and encourage the use of telehealth by behavioral health. And they refer to prohibiting the board of licensed professional counselors, marital and family therapists, board of psychologists and psych associates, and social workers from imposing disciplinary sanctions on the licensees. They also, those same sections require those associated boards to adopt standards of care through regulation.
Continue.
Sections 3, 4, and 5 are telehealth for physicians, and we anticipate these will help expand psychiatric coverage. These provisions also dovetail nicely with the provisions in Section 30 of this bill, D5, line 26, and they allow the department to provide incentives for telehealth. Our first step in implementing that provision will be to convene a work group, including stakeholders from the healthcare community, in order to identify some of the legal, technological, and financial barriers to increasing the use of telehealth. So there'll be more information about telehealth in tomorrow's hearing, but I wanted to point out that this bill supports telehealth for behavioral health services. One of the significant key sections of the bill is Section 28, beginning on page 25, and that creates the Medical Assistance Reform Program. Section B on page 26, line 18, requires the department in coordination with the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority to efficiently manage a comprehensive and integrated behavioral health program that uses evidence-based, data-driven practices to achieve positive outcomes. And this is really key. A lot of work went into crafting this section, I know, with the trust. This will provide us the opportunity to address some of the gaps in the continuum, particularly in the lower levels of care, as well as in some of the higher levels like crisis stabilization that we can use as diversion to API, for example, or step down from API to help people with mental illness either be diverted from hospital level of care or stabilize in the community following hospital level of care. The program required under Section 28 must include a plan for providing a continuum of community-based services. And we heard Mr. Curry talk about how important those community supports are in wrapping around people with addictions and mental illness in terms of addressing the housing and the employment needs that they have. The bill also requires in this section that there be services provided from a wide array of providers and disciplines. And this gives us the opportunity to look at some of the regulations and practices that we have in place that may have been useful at one time, but maybe aren't as useful now. So it gives us opportunity to look at which providers can provide which services in which settings under what conditions. And so we have somewhat of a fragmented system of that. And so this section of the bill basically says that the community behavioral health program must address that. It also must include efforts to reduce the operational barriers and administrative burdens. And I think we've heard in this committee in earlier testimony about some of the just burdens that the providers experience that are impeding access for consumers. And so, again, this sets us up well to look at some of those issues more closely. Section 30 of the bill on pages beginning on page 29 starts the waiver section, and that section is really key to reform in the behavioral health reforms. Section F, beginning on page 30, line 9, requires the department to apply for an 1115 behavioral health Medicaid waiver from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to establish a demonstration project focused on improving the behavioral health system for Medicaid recipients. And it requires the department to engage the stakeholder in the community. And again, we heard Mr. Charlie just answer questions about how important that is to do. And so we definitely look forward to that process and see it as critical to success. And also the waiver, it must be consistent with the comprehensive integrated behavioral health program that we just identified in Section 28. So to talk a little bit about the waiver, the purpose of this 1115 waiver is to create and evaluate an innovative service delivery system that improves care, increases efficiency, and manages costs. The general criteria that CMS uses to review waiver applications, they ask questions such as, does it increase the access to, does it stabilize and strengthen providers and provider networks? When they look at our application, we'll have to show that it will improve health outcomes. They'll ask, will it increase the efficiency and the quality of care? And is it budget neutral? During the course of the waiver, the federal Medicaid expenditures can't be any more than federal spending without the waiver. So the array of services we propose will have to be offset by reductions elsewhere such as reducing emergency department expenditures by providing lower cost crisis stabilization. So budget neutrality is a key piece of this waiver, and something that we'll have to work very hard to ensure that we meet. The waivers are usually for 5 years, and you can request an extension, I think, of up to 3 years. And then also, as part of the waiver, as Mr. Curry mentioned, we're planning to use an administrative services organization to help move the system from the program management to more quality management, to a system that's based on outcomes as opposed to fee-for-service. I think ask Randall if he'd like to offer any comments about the waiver or the ASL.
Yeah, place yourself on the record, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Randall Burns. I'm the director of the Division of Behavioral Health. We wanted to focus specifically on what it might take to apply for an 1115 behavioral health waiver, and so I'm just going to mention some of the processes involved. As Karen mentioned, it's 5 years. It is also a research demonstration, so it is required to have a foundational hypothesis that we have to test throughout the process of the demonstration. It must have a strong ongoing evaluation component and it measuring the effects of the redesign on the system of care. And as Karen mentioned, it can't cost the federal government more without the waiver. However, I think it's important to note that we have throughout the period of the 5 years, so that by the end of that time, we have established cost neutrality, which essentially allows us at some point, since we're talking about expanding services in areas that are missing, we just need to be able to show that the cost set-offs that Karen mentioned, by the end of the demonstration, we have not expended any more Medicaid. One of the first tasks that we have here, actually within the next 6 months, is we're going to be drafting a proposal, a concept paper, that we will introduce to CMS that our interest in an 1115 behavioral health waiver. We want to file this by September 1st, and it will reflect a lot of the work that the Mental Health Board, the Mental Health Trust and Alcohol Board, the behavioral health providers, other departments in the state, the court system, sister divisions within our department, the hospital association, consumers, et cetera, will all have a role in helping us plan and have the pieces of that concept paper. And that will, in fact, be sort of the beginning of a long and intense period of communication with all of those stakeholders, not only through the filing of the actual application, but also during the implementation of the waiver itself. At the same time that we're working on the application, there's two other things, and I noticed you all had some questions that Mr. Curie mentioned. The first one is there will be a readiness assessment of current DBH staff completed. Given that the role of DBH will be changing, if there's an administrative services organization in place, the staff will be responsible more for ensuring the operations and the success of the ASO rather than becoming grant managers. So in order to prepare the staff for this reengineering of their roles, there is a readiness assessment that will be conducted that will assess their current knowledge, skills, and abilities within the context of the identified competencies necessary for overseeing a managed care system. And then once we've identified any gaps in those through that readiness assessment, then training would be provided to the staff where we identified those gaps in the skill base. At the same time, we'll also be doing a provider assessment in order to essentially determine the extent to which the present providers are prepared for a more intensely managed system of care. This includes reviewing their present management structure, their financial capacity, their clinical capacity, and their information and data reporting capacities. And again, as with the division staff assessment, once we've identified any gaps in those services, we would then provide training to the staff and of those agencies and also their boards of directors. Once we file that concept paper and we begin our conversation with CMS, we'll actually begin drafting the application. The application is extraordinarily detailed. It will take months in collaboration with those stakeholders that I mentioned, including the behavioral health providers, of course. The application requires a program description, information on the persons and the populations that will be participating in the demonstration, the benefits and services that will be provided under the waiver, what delivery system will be selected, will it be in as we have opted in ASO format, the anticipated implementation date, how the demonstration will be financed and how it will meet its budget neutrality goals, and then also ensuring that the public notice requirements of the waiver are met. We intend to actually file this application by July of 2017, which is only a year and a few months away. And then once filed, a negotiation begins between the state and CMS over the content of the sections of its application. We know from the consultants like Mr. Curry and Stephanie Colston that this can take just a few months, and it has taken as long as 3 years. As we are writing the application, there's also one other thing that's occurring, and that's the request for information around the ASO, the Administrative Services Organization. As you have heard probably ad nauseum by now, an ASO is a third party with whom the department would contract to manage Alaska's redesigned behavioral health care system. It would provide the department with national expertise around a managed Medicaid system of care and help the transition of the division to a program management model. This change is seen as key to the success of the 1115 behavioral health waiver and also later the 1115 SUD waiver. The contract with the ASO could include significant incentives within the payment structure, with flexibility for the ASO to pass on incentives to providers for achievement of quality and the network targets. One of our issues, and the reason we're going to start with the RFI, is that, as you know, RFIs are used to gather information to help make a decision on what steps to take next. And in gathering basic information, it's often used then in the solicitation of the RFP itself. We intend to release the RFI for the ASO in February of next year, just a little less than a year from now. And the information we discovered during that RFI process about the interest of any ASO in working in Alaska and under what conditions will help inform our drafting of the waiver application by July of that year. There are some concerns around the ASO, given our geography, our frontier nature, the ruralness of our setting and how spread out our communities are, and the relative differences in sizes. We'll be interested in the responses to the RFI from the ASOs about their interest in contracting to provide those services in Alaska. Based on the quality and the nature of the responses, and assuming negotiations with CMS appear promising, the department would then release an RFP for those services during the first quarter of FY18, so a year and a half from now. And if successful, the ASO contract respondent would be in place and actively working to create the networks and have the services in place by the time the 1115 waiver is actually granted. The integration and primary case management health home models are key to this redesign effort, and the integration at this is probably, in fact, the primary care management and health home models are key to our redesign efforts, and we believe we would start there as we move through our system redesign. After a year or more of operations under the new waiver, the state would then apply for an SUD waiver, hoping to eliminate the IMD exclusion for substance use disorder treatment. I'll stop there and return it to Deputy Commissioner Forrest.
Ms. Burkhardt, place yourself on the record. We'll hear your presentation. Ms. Forrest.
Thank you. I wanted to just say a couple more things about the bill. Section 31, page 30, is the emergency department section and requires the department to collaborate with the Statewide Hospital Association to reduce the use of emergency department services by Medicaid recipients. And we see this as important to the behavioral health system, as we know that some of the folks with mental illness show up in the ER, and this is an opportunity for us to work together to ensure that they're either diverted and or directed to the right service following ER use. Section 31, page 31, is the coordinated care demonstration project, and it requires the department to contract with one or more third parties to implement a coordinated care demonstration. And again, one element of this project could be comprehensive primary care case management for Medicaid recipients, including behavioral health. So that's an important piece for the behavioral health system redesign as well. Also, I wanted to mention section 33, beginning on page 35, it removes the requirement for outpatient community mental health clinics and physician clinics to be a grantee in order to bill Medicaid for clinic services. That's lines 2 through 6. Section 34, which is lines 7 through 14, removes the requirement for outpatient community mental health clinics and drug and alcohol treatment centers to be a grantee or contractor in order to bill Medicaid for rehabilitation services. And I wanted to make sure that the committee had the information that these changes are required by CMS. In our last on-site evaluation, CMS made it clear to the department that these requirements had to be removed. There is a general provision that Medicaid allow any willing and qualified provider to participate in Medicaid. This comes from the freedom of choice provision. And we have essentially restricted access and restricted freedom of choice for Medicaid recipients with those requirements. So as the state Medicaid agency, we do have the ability to set reasonable standards related to the qualifications of the provider. CMS generally questions state-established qualifications that effectively limit services only to the providers of the state's choosing. So we have promised to change that, and CMS has promised to provide us technical assistance in doing so. So we can still do that if we want to use entirely general fund dollars, but in order to bill Medicaid, we need to have those sections of the bill repeal those requirements. I also wanted to mention Section 39, which begins on page 37, which is the health information infrastructure section. And it requires the department to develop a health information infrastructure plan to strengthen health information infrastructure and data analytics. And there is a need to connect the behavioral health providers to the Alaska Statewide Health Information Exchange to improve care coordination and to connect AK-AIMS, which is the electronic health record for behavioral health services, to the HIE for more efficiencies and streamlining of provider requirements. So that section is important as well. And last, section 40, beginning on page 38, line 14B, requires the department, together with the trust, to procure a study to analyze the feasibility of privatizing services at the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. So those all sections of the bill, I think, really set the stage well for the very thorough and comprehensive vision that Mr. Curry demonstrated and talked through his slide presentation. And again, the purpose of behavioral health reform is to improve the access, improve quality, and reduce the overall cost of healthcare. I also just wanted to note that, you know, with behavioral health reform, we would anticipate coming back to the legislature next year with any statutory or statutory changes that would be needed to help support the reform efforts. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Burkhardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Kate Burkhardt. I am the executive director of the Alaska Mental Health Board and the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. These boards were established by statute to serve as the state planning councils for mental health and substance abuse. So my comments today are relative to the board's role in the process that led us to where we are today, and in particular, niche that we served in informing the process. The boards have been involved in healthcare reform and Medicaid reform efforts for many, many years. The process over the last 18 to 24 months has by far been the most inclusive. You've heard a lot about the stakeholder process. You've heard from provider organizations and professional organizations involved. The boards participated in those conversations and stakeholder sessions. And then we offered, and the department accepted that offer, to engage with Medicaid recipients. Because it seems like if you're going to reform a system, you would go ask the people that receive services from that system how it's going and how they think it could be improved. The boards engaged in 8 of those community conversations in the fall last year and went back and reviewed the public input from our community town halls and our public meetings and our streamlining initiative to compile that consumer input to inform the process. And what we learned is that the experts probably know what they're talking about because the recipients had a lot of the same ideas and concerns. They just expressed them differently. Access to care is always the majority of the comment the boards receive. And it's not just access to any care. It's access to high-quality services at the appropriate levels of care. And you've heard from the administration and others about how the behavioral health system is able or not able to provide that. When asked, okay, that's the problem, now what is the solution? These groups of consumers and their family members and their caregivers and the community members that support them spoke about the need to have increased access to medication management and psychiatry services. The telehealth provisions and the coordinated care provisions in SB 74 speak to that. They talked about having increased access to private mental health professionals, therapists that are not practicing within community behavioral health centers. SB 74 speaks to that, the provisions that Deputy Commissioner Forrest just mentioned. The ability to receive care when they need it and not 3 months from now is essential to addressing a lot of the not just health care concerns that the legislature and the administration and communities are dealing with, but also the relevant social problems that kind of flow from unaddressed behavioral health disorders. And so many of the provisions that have been brought to your attention in SB 74 speak to that. The consumers we talked with talked about a need to address the quality of behavioral health services that are available and the quality of primary care services that are available. Not necessarily the quality of the actual medical service provided, but the context in which it is provided, the issues of stigma and discrimination, as well as a lack of understanding of how to serve someone with a serious mental illness who also has gout or some other kind of comorbidity. Families, especially families of children with serious emotional and behavioral disorders, talked about how they often had to aggressively advocate for their children's health care services, not just their behavioral health services, but their primary care needs as well. SB 74 provides a framework in which, through care coordination, the primary care case management project, and the 1115 waiver, as well as some of the state plan options you've heard about, will allow for things like patient advocacy and navigation through very complex systems. When we first started having these conversations among the department leadership and the kind of grasstop stakeholders, we also heard, you know, it's really complicated, and it would be great if there was somebody to help me understand my insurance. So what we are seeing in SB 74 is a framework that will allow the department to implement these kinds of reforms that make it easier for people to get to the services they need rather than accessing the acute care services we want to avoid. Coordination of care came up repeatedly in conversations with community members. Often the kind of coordination we think about coordinating between a behavioral health provider and a physician or a psychiatrist and a primary care provider. But then we also heard stories of, my children have such serious health needs, behavioral health needs and primary care needs, that all of my time in the doctor's office is about them. And when I ask the pediatrician about my elbow, because I don't have time to go to the doctor, the pediatrician can't help me because he's my child's doctor. And so one of the benefits to these consumer conversations is we received the input that informed these overarching kind of systems changes, but we are also receiving granular kinds of information for when we get to implementation, we can start thinking about what actually is the care we're coordinating and can it be family-based as well as recipient-based. Another example of how the provisions in SB 74 around primary care case management are relevant to my particular constituency is in one of our consumer conversations, a young man was talking about his brother who has significant mental health as well as primary care needs and doesn't want to go to all of his appointments. He's a teenager. He doesn't really want to do anything anybody tells him to do. And his brother said, what we need is a big guy who will follow him around and make sure he gets where he needs to go and gets the care he needs. Well, whether the person is big or small, that idea of the primary care case management, especially with the flexibility to where the case management is provided by the organization most adept at serving that kind of client, which may be a behavioral health provider, will allow families to ensure that their loved ones receive the care they need, but they don't have to be the big guy. We have a case management or a care coordination project that can do that. So that, I think, was reassuring as we started talking more and more about the care management and care coordination and some of the fears that we were expecting from consumers, that they wouldn't want to be managed. What we actually heard was it would be great if somebody helped me get where I needed to go in an organized fashion and better comply with the health care that I need. We also heard about the need for administrative efficiencies. You hear from providers and you've heard from the boards about the need to streamline our administrative burden to reduce costs and make it easier to get to care. What we learned in these conversations is that is affecting the care that people receive. When paperwork drives care rather than the person's needs driving the care plan, they don't get the care that helps them get better. And so I think that was illustrative for many of us when we were hearing about the need for administrative efficiencies from the clients themselves to reduce the paperwork they had to fill out or that they felt that their healthcare provider was having to fill out. We heard about the need for supportive services, and SB 74 provides for reforming the Medicaid system in a way that correlates the reforms to the healthcare services with the needed community supports to make those healthcare services as effective as possible. The need to engage Medicaid recipients and their families and their caregivers in these kinds of conversations will continue throughout the development of the 1115 waiver, as well as the implementation of many of the provisions in SB 74. And that's one of the areas where the boards are committed to supporting the implementation of these efforts, is ensuring not only that our constituents have an opportunity to inform the process, but they have an opportunity to be informed about the process. Anytime something is done to you, I think we feel like we don't want to be done to. And so the boards have the ability to transform this into something that we're doing together. It's done with. And especially for folks with disabilities, whether they're behavioral health disabilities or other disabilities, having that that process where you're doing with is exceptionally important. And so we're very appreciative of the department's willingness and actually enthusiasm for engaging in this kind of inclusivity in their reform efforts.
Are you ready for questions? Representative Sadler.
Whoosh.
That was a lot.
That was a lot of good information, and to appreciate it better, we're going to have to ask some probing questions. So, through the chair, I'm going to ask, I want to make sure, I'll ask Karen. My reading of the bill indicates that there's actually directives to apply for two different 1115 waivers, one for aiming at geographic providers and one specifically for Medicaid recipients. Is that correct understanding of the bill?
Through the chair, yes.
Okay. Would all the same conditions and timelines apply to those, you know, for both of them?
Through the chair, I think I'll have to defer to a lifeline, Mr. Sherwood, on the other waiver.
Okay.
We'll have him up very shortly. You hold that, or do you want to?
Well, actually, I'm going to take advantage of my time to ask questions and toss out as many as I can here. Mr. Burns. Is your Division of Behavioral Health ready for the significant transformation that's described here?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I think we are. I think that people are well aware of some of the system problems. Most of the staff are program managers. They deal with systems. They answer the phone every day from the public calling about this problem, and the service isn't there. I think they're committed to trying to improve the system, and I think identifying what kinds of additional education and information they need to learn in order to convert themselves into a contract manager kind of staffing is something that they're interested in and willing to take on.
Okay.
Representative Sadler, another.
Thank you. I guess I'll throw out a real general question. We're talking about spending a lot of time, resources, effort to rearrange the system, and this is maybe an unfair question, but how effective is behavioral health? I mean, if we put money, resources, time into this, what's the best outcome we can hope for in the population we're trying to reach? That's you.
Is that to me?
Probably.
Representative Sadler, through the chair. I think behavioral health is very effective. We have many, many, many individuals in this state who have been served by the community behavioral health system quite well. There are gaps in the services, and those are sometimes relatively famous in terms of the negative press, et cetera. But the system itself, as Mr. Curry mentioned, it has for the last many years been focused specifically on treating the seriously mentally ill, and also the SED children. And those are the most difficult of the entire population, and I think we've done as good a job as we can given the range of services that we have available to them. And it's a difficult population to serve because their needs change relatively quickly sometimes. Medication management is an issue, but I have no doubts that the behavioral health system is highly effective in providing the services that it's funded and capable of providing.
Last question. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I appreciate the committee's indulgence as well. So on page 30, line 1, we speak of the 1115 waiver for a demonstration project for innovative payment models for one or more groups of medical assistance recipients in one or more specific geographic areas. So I guess, Karen, is that how would you define areas, and which is likely to be the area or areas that would get that demonstration project? Is it going to be those that are least served, you know, rural Alaska, or highly served like Anchorage or Fairbanks? Help me understand.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, a geographic area will be defined, will have to be determined. We haven't defined those yet. It will have to be a service area, and we'll be looking at utilization and what some of the needs are in that community.
Small, how big?
Well, it could be an area like Anchorage, or it could be a community outside of Anchorage, or it could be a region of the state. We have not defined that yet. And I think I want to ask Randall if you want to add to that.
Representative Sadler, I think that our hope would be that the ASO would be interested in a statewide system, and that then they might subcontract if there were entities interested in providing those services on a regional basis. And so I think it could be a combination. You could have a statewide system with subcontractors for some very specific regions where, for instance, maybe a tribal provider wants to provide the services for a particular area and could be subcontracted with as an ASO.
I asked my last question. I'll make a brief comment. Just that there's a lot of places in this rather large bill where there's a tremendous amount of flexibility, and we really, voting here in the House floor, we will not know to what we're voting for and how big an effect or how big a machine we're going to be building here. So that's one. While I support the goal of this bill, I have a lot of questions about just what exactly, how big a poke is this pig in?
If I might just make one comment, I think the goal here, as has been stated, is to improve the system and keep costs under control. And as long as that is our focus, I think that is the goal in front of all of us, and I think that will guide the system that's developed.
Thank you. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. My concerns, I guess, were right along the lines with Representative Sadler, is there's a whole lot of new requirements for the department, commitments, changes in regulations, requests for changes that we absolutely have no idea about because the regulations haven't been written, and I don't know how to go about analyzing it, Mr. Co-Chair, but I guess we'll work this. Now, looking on page 30, section 31, this collaborative hospital-based project, again, we are using a statewide professional hospital association. How many of those are there?
One. The answer is one for Mr. Burns.
One. Yeah, that's what I thought. So we've got one, so they're already labeled. And another thing, Mr. Chair, what I've noticed is when the lady from the advisory board for drug and alcohol abuse was talking, it seems that, and I've participated in these meetings, and we all have, and it's a lot of different professional organizations that all talk to each other. But as she mentioned, very few times do they actually talk to the people who are affected by this. And I would like to see ways to measure out the effectiveness before we throw in a whole bunch of regulation changes and how they affect the people. And we've all dealt with stories here that, I mean, regulations don't catch. And the regulations that tried to fix them were probably the problem to start with. I just don't know where to go on this. I don't know the costs on these things, Mr. Co-Chair. But I have concerns, I think, as the Vice Chair did. Also, if I have just one more follow-up question, I don't know quite who to ask. A lot of these new regulations that we get seem to be a stick and carrot from the federal government. Take this federal money, and now you have to follow these new federal regulations. One of you up there just said the rules are required because we accept federal funds. Karen Forrest said that. So what new federal requirements do we have to accept because we're accepting federal funds, Mr. Co-Chair. I'd like a list of that, if we could get that, the changes, what funds we're getting, the federal changes, the requirements that are we going to have to accept because we accepted these federal monies. We should know that stuff before we pass laws that create this new regulations on our people.
We'll see if we can get that listing and comparisons from the department.
And I'll just follow up as we go along, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Next, we have Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for being here today. Thanks for the explanation. I have a couple questions just on the 1115 waiver that we request. Is it required by federal statute that we go through an accountable care organization or managed care organization for the 1115?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair. No, that's the how you manage that is entirely up to you, to the state. So, no, it's not a requirement.
And through the chair? And so the reason you're going through an accountable care organization model is because it's worked in other states. Can you just address that?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair. That and because they have expertise that really we're not familiar with managed Medicaid too well in this state. These are organizations, hopefully, that apply that have a great deal of experience in working on managed care or organizations. And for that reason alone, we would do the RFP to see what kind of interest there was in assisting the state in moving forward on a managed Medicaid system.
And then thank you. And so I'm not sure if this section applies, but is it still can the state still run its own managed care organization under this part of the statute, under the 1115s?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair. Yes, the state could decide not to contract with an ASO and run it through its own, through the department.
Okay. And then, second section. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then on the question, we have the documents from the recommended strategies in the final report, and it talks about the behavioral access initiative expected to produce net costs to Medicaid because there's going to be enrollees that are better able to access the service. You mentioned, I think it was earlier, that at the end of the five-year waiver term, you'd have to prove that it's net neutral to Medicaid. Is that just within behavioral health, or because it also mentions that it will potentially offset general fund savings elsewhere using, an example, behavioral health grant funds or Department of Corrections spending?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, ultimately the savings that that will be accrued are measured not just on behavioral health, but if there are other savings to the system, like, for instance, the possible savings with the demonstration project with the emergency rooms, where we can show savings as partially, of course, associated with behavioral health treatment.
Okay. And then just one last question, Mr. Chair.
Last question, Representative.
Thank you. There's we have a list of all the current optional and mandatory waiver services that we've got, including waivers, I'm sorry, mandatory services under Medicaid, and there's 19 that are mandatory for adults. There's another 26 that we've applied to optionally. Some of them are waivered. Can you tell me, so what's the overall cost? What would the overall cost be? I guess, you know, we've added a lot of optional waivers, and I just want to make sure down the road that either way it goes that we know how to pay for them.
You're asking for the overall cost of the optionals that have been added?
That's a probably different question. I'm just curious what the total all-in, Mr. Chairman, would be for the 1115 waiver if we were to assume that we would not net cost to the state.
That's an in-depth question we might have to go a little deeper on.
Right. Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, we will be going through the fiscal notes, and so we will be going through all the costs related to the behavioral health initiative. So if we could, we would go through it at that time.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Kawasaki. Next, we have Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the front page of the Agnew-Beck report. It's repeated inside of it. I think it's pretty succinct. The goals for this redesign and expansion is improve health, optimize access, increase value, and contain costs. I hope within this process that you will get to a place where you can illustrate how those things will be accomplished. But tomorrow we're doing telemedicine, but you have been bringing it up, so I have a question. You live in a world of delivering these services, and there's only two simple places in the bill which actually could cripple this whole operation for telemedicine. And it's on page 27, line 26, and 33, line 15, and it just says a report on recommendations for the ability to be cost-effective for telemedicine. There's significant barriers for delivering telemedicine in this state. You know, I would hate, Mr. Burns did a wonderful job lining out the ISOs, going through the RFIs, going through the RFPs, but at the end of the day, I just hope somebody asks, what are our current capabilities in broadband across the state? Because you can get somebody to put in a bid and a request and a proposal and then find out that they're completely incapable of delivering the services because something outside your expertise, and there's a lot of it here, didn't explore that to the extent that it needs to be. Because I've been exploring some of the broadband problems in the state, and there are significant barriers. I mean, if you talk about a rural village or community that has to have a someplace where they're delivering services, and it's simply not there for anybody. You have hit a barrier to delivery of services that's not within the medical community. And how do you penetrate that bubble and get outside and fix that? So I don't know if you have discussed that, or maybe tomorrow's a better time to deal with it, but I hope there's going to be a dialogue about delivering telemedicine and the real capabilities of delivering telemedicine instead of just simply saying, we want to do this. Because I think that's great, and I think it's going to be cost-effective and savings and increase value and increase access. But is it real? That's my question.
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, that is a real concern, and we are looking forward to that conversation. And we do need to have some organized, structured, focused discussion around what systems we have, what the capabilities are, what the barriers are, what the broadband capabilities are. We know that in the tribal health world, for example, that...
Can you speak into the microphone, please?
I apologize.
Please. Yes.
We know in the tribal health system that there has been some good success using telemedicine and telehealth. And so we're looking forward to seeing what we can learn from those entities, including AMTHC, which is already using that. So those conversations need to happen, and this sets the stage for us to begin to do that.
A follow-up question.
Follow-up, Representative Guttenberg.
Representative Kawasaki asked a question about the ASOs and if the state wanted to do it. Now, that's one question. But my question deals with if the ASO, one comes in and takes over the whole state, and then you have five or six regional programs that are doing it, a Native corporation in rural Alaska, something down here in Southeast, something in the interior. What about the administrative overburden of having too many people managing something that it becomes cost-effective, or just the administrative costs become burdensome to the goal of driving costs down? Have you thought about that?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, I think that is a very good question. I don't know that we've fully explored it, but certainly in other states, we know from their experience, that they've started out in some locations, and then over time they actually have moved statewide. And those are either managed individually by the region. As far as I'm aware of, they haven't tried, if they're doing it on a regional basis, I'm not aware of them there being an overarching ASO on top of that. They're done regionally. So I think it's a choice that the state has about how it approaches, how it wants to organize the delivery of care within the state, by region, whatever it might be.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. I recognize in the pilot program, you'll probably be ended up doing regional delivery of services. But the one in Southeast is different from the one on the North Slope, is different. So the ability to translate one to the other isn't necessarily going to work. So I'm concerned that you're going to do a pilot program in Southeast or out on the Aleutians, and then somebody's going to say, well, this is success, and move it into another region where it's inappropriate. Is that part of the dialogue you're having with delivering of?
Representative Gutner, through the chair, I think that's a very important dialogue, but I think, again, that's one of the advantages of the system, is that then in drafting the RFP, if we decided, for instance, for whatever reasons, after talking with all the providers and the various communities, we wanted to at least try one regional, let's say, then we would write the RFP so that it was specifically addressing the populations and the services and the uniqueness of that area, and we would design it for that purpose. We wouldn't write just sort of a generic RFP. We would focus on the needs and the populations and the services that we wanted them to manage in that area.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Next we have Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So let's say this bill doesn't pass. What in the bill could you still do because you already have the authority? And I'm talking just about behavioral health. I'm not talking about the entire bill. But just what you're talking about today, what could you still do even if this bill were not to pass?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, that's a very good question. I haven't spent time looking at section by section. I think we probably could pursue an 1115 without, I think the ability to contract and some of the unique service deliveries sort of considered under the 1115, I'd have to talk maybe, and Deputy Commissioner Sherwood could answer that, but there might be provisions within Medicaid that would require this amendment so that we actually, because it's allowing us to do things that we couldn't do generally under the Medicaid system and our state Medicaid plan now. And I'm just not an expert there.
And a follow-up?
Sherwood will be up in a little while. We can ask him that also. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I guess, you know, we've had Medicaid for a long time, and I'm really disturbed that we're sitting here right now talking about that we're not helping people through the system and that we're not getting the right services to the people at the right time. And we're spending a lot of money not doing those things. So I'm more interested in the managed care portion of it that we've been talking about, no matter which one of the types that you're talking about. So if I understand you correctly, and maybe it's Mr. Sherwood, I may be asking the wrong person, but so if I understand you correctly, you could not go out and contract to have somebody be able to manage, you know, I mean, we all have management plans, so that these issues could have been taken care of years ago.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, you know, that's a very good question. I have assumed, and again, maybe Deputy Commissioner Sherwood can answer that. I do know that one of the reasons for the gaps has been that until recently, Medicaid wasn't covering a large portion of the population. So as a result of expansion, it's the expansion that allows us then to really start to look at this system more holistically, because we were sort of looking at the younger children and the elderly and not really capable dealing with the adult SMI population. We'd use grants for some of that, but there were limitations there, and I think that's the reason we're really working on this now, is because we can look at this population-based.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
I guess I'm where Representative Newman was going as well. So I guess, you know, with all the funding in the billions of dollars that we have spent on Medicaid, not just for young children, for older people, but in mental health grants and all those others, I guess unless I can understand where all the issues have been and where the money's been going to all the grants and what we haven't been covering, can I possibly understand what this does unless telehealth is going to bring in a whole lot of doctors and therapists that we currently don't have here in the state of Alaska? I just don't know how we get there, and I'd ask the question to your office if I knew what the question was, except what is the history, where have we been, and then as you talk about these gaps, do we actually have people currently in the state who could fill those gaps, or is the problem we don't have enough behavioral health specialists in the state, and we're going to lay all of our marbles, for better way, into hoping that we can do it all online?
You want me to jump in?
Yeah, sure.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, this is Kate Burkhart. You've identified some of the most critical issues, and that is the workforce capacity. One of the goals of the system transformation and the redesign is to help alleviate some of the workforce capacity issues we're having in the community behavioral health system by allowing private practitioners to bill Medicaid as well. Right now, a private licensed marriage and family therapist is not able to provide therapy to a Medicaid recipient if they're practicing under their own shingle. And so for folks who have mild to moderate behavioral health disorders, often, and they're Medicaid recipients, they often go without care until they develop an acute mental illness, and then the community behavioral health center serves them because they're a priority population. And so by removing the grantee requirement, SB 74 says private licensed mental health professionals can now provide reimbursable services to Medicaid recipients, and that opens up workforce capacity, especially for the mild to moderate needs that are going unaddressed, which we would hope with effective treatment, those folks don't develop the acute mental health needs that are arising in the community behavioral health center, and will leave some, not mountains, but some of the pressure on the community mental health centers. So workforce capacity is a critical issue. It's been a critical issue in the healthcare system for years now, and can be addressed in different ways. But one of the specific ways SB 74 does it is in those two provisions whose numbers I don't remember, 33 and 34, that take the grantee requirement out of the statute. So SB 74 would address that issue in that particular way that you've raised.
And Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
And I guess this is a request. My problem with the bill is really trying to understand what we absolutely have to have in statute so that it can be done, and what, you know, can be done, and for whatever reason somebody wants it in statute. So if a chart could be put on the sections on what the department could be doing and just for whatever reason have chosen not to do it, and what absolutely has to be done in statute so that we can get to whatever stage that we're trying to get to. But right now, I'm in a real gray area trying to figure out between those two. So a chart showing that would be very helpful to me.
Thank you. We are scheduled to only go to 3:30, but we will continue on. We have more presenters, another PowerPoint presentation yet to go, so we will stay till we're finished. Stay here, everybody. We're not done with questions yet. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've heard a number of the questions, but I think from the information I've been reading, this bill does the opposite to what we've heard. I mean, it addresses some of the issues by relieving workforce shortages. It addresses some of the issues by leveraging extra federal funding, and I want to ask some questions about that. Ms. Forrest, on the 1115 waiver, one of the representatives asked you how much that would cost, but the 1115 waiver is projected to save over $200 million in state general funds over the next 5 years. Do I have that wrong?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, I think you're referring to the tribal policy.
Right.
Right.
Okay, not this is the tribal portion of it.
Right. Right, it's not, which doesn't require a waiver at this point to do.
And through the chair.
Representative Garrett.
And then the non-tribal part of the 1115 waiver, does that leverage additional federal funds as well or no?
The 1115 behavioral health Medicaid waiver gives us the opportunity to provide more services that are additional services and package those services in a way to improve the effectiveness. So that's kind of the general concept, and you're going to hear more about waivers from Mr. Sherwood.
Thanks. Through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
And by doing that, will that qualify those services for Medicaid payment? Mm-hmm. Is that the idea?
Through the chair, yes. Representative Guerra.
Through the chair. And those would be services that otherwise would have to be paid for with solely general funds?
Representative Guerra, yes.
Okay. And then I'm trying to...
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm trying to understand the dividing line between the 1115 waiver on behavioral health and this issue that's come up. Under current law, for us to provide certain social work, psychologist, other behavioral health treatment, it either has to be done to get Medicaid coverage in a federally qualified medical center or with a psychiatrist present. Is that correct?
Representative Gary, yes.
And we're trying to avoid that role because of the limitation that we have in workforce on psychiatrists. So is it the 1115 waiver that helps us avoid that role, or is that some other part of the bill?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, yes, it is, as well as Section 28 allows us to do that. So right now it's a requirement in federal law, and then we have a regulation that says that the federal law is that if you provide those services in a physician's clinic, you have to be supervised, that be provided under the general direction of a physician. And so we have established regulation around that for both physician clinics and community mental health clinics. And so those regulations are things that we can go ahead and change, but we will be looking at that through the development of the 1115 waiver, looking at our regulations that allow for expanding access at the same time maintaining budget neutrality.
Through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. So if the 1115 waiver is pursued and successful, we'll now be able to provide those behavioral health services without the supervision of a physician, a psychologist, and without being inside a federally recognized qualified medical health center. Is that correct?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, the 1115 will help us look at our utilization patterns across the state, that being one of them, and give us the opportunity to look and refine those regulations to where that will make more sense going forward. And so that's one of the things that we will be looking at. And so we have to have more conversation about that, but yes.
And then finally, Mr. Chair.
Final Representative Guerra.
As we're talking about this segment of behavioral health treatment that currently is limited by having to be provided to get Medicaid coverage either in a federally qualified health center or under the supervision of a psychiatrist or doctor, as we look at trying to get this segment of behavioral health services done without those requirements, does that include behavioral health for drug and alcohol abuse, treatment for drug and alcohol abuse patients, and as well as other mental health disorders, or is it just some segmented portion of behavioral health treatment?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, it refers to clinic services, which could also apply to substance abuse, yes.
All right. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Guerra. Next, we have Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be brief. I wanted to tag along with behind Representative Kawasaki when he spoke of the 26 optional services, and something that we haven't really had a broad conversation here, and when we get to that point, you know, whether it's in the fiscal note, I'd like to be sure, so I kind of want to be sure I'm passing it on so they're ready, that we not only talk about the actual fiscal aspects, but what they are, why we decided to take them, why we, you know, what the options are of not accepting them, have they already been accepted, and what it takes to undo, kind of the broader conversation. And where I'm coming from is folks in my district, and I hear lots of folks saying, well, why do we have 26? Why do we have this Cadillac service, so on and so forth? So I really think that having at least the conversation, why we have it, when we did it, you know, what it takes to undo it, because I don't think it's as simple as most folks out there think. And so I would like to have that a little bit broader conversation when we get to that point. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gaddis. We're back to Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My understanding of for Karen is that I thought you said that the system we have right now says that, for example, a licensed mental, marital or family therapist cannot bill Medicaid because they are not providing services under contract. Do I understand it correctly that the change in national policy, I forget which section it is, that would remove that requirement to be a contract recipient or grant recipient before you could provide services? Is that the mechanism by which we would expand provision of health care services, of behavioral health services? Let me restate that more clearly if I can. There's a provision here that eliminates, it's on page 35, line 12 and 13, that removes the requirement that rehabilitative services have to be provided by someone at a community mental health services under contract. Is that one of the mechanisms by which we will expand capacity? Okay.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, yes.
Okay, good. So let me understand, too. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This proposes that we're going to, this bill proposes several demonstration projects that are going to take quite a while to design, quite a while to implement, and during the pendency of that time, the existing behavioral health service system will continue to operate. Is there enough capacity to continue to operate and meet the needs, or are we going to be constricting ourselves for the next 3 or 4 years?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, there is enough capacity. I think that it is a heavy lift to reform the system at the same time that you're delivering services. And so it's going to take a lot of coordinated, concentrated effort, extra work, and lots of good communication and excellent planning and implementation. But we are going to have to do that.
May I add to that?
Follow up. Ms. Burkhart has a reply to that also, Representative Sadler.
So this is Kate Burkhart. Our providers actually move quite a bit of this change and are already engaged in quite a bit of the transformation that SB 74 contemplates. Around the integration of primary care and behavioral health and coordination of care and case management, we have community mental health centers, community behavioral health centers that have added primary care capacity. Juno Alliance for Mental Health here in Juno, hence the name, has added a primary care clinic on the first floor so that they can do that. Anchorage Community Mental Health Services has had primary care capacity for several years. We have providers already moving down this road. So they not only will inform based on what they've learned through their experiences, but will help bring their peers along. The Department of Health and Social Services is a recipient of one of only 14 planning, is that right, 14? 24? I knew there was a 4 in there somewhere. 24 planning grants for certified community behavioral health clinics, which are a federally supported model for integrated, coordinated health care from soup to nuts, head to foot health care. And we applied for those funds with the support of the behavioral health provider community. They were eager to go down that road. So I think that in some ways, there are provider organizations who have a greater capacity for this kind of change because they have been engaged in it already.
Thank you. Follow up. Thank you. Last follow up, Representative Sadler.
I'll make it a broad question then. Okay. I was able to find a 2009 report on the availability of clinics for health care around Alaska, which has been very helpful. I would love to be able to put my hands on a similar, analogous report of behavioral. And we just talked about, I think, federally qualified mental health clinics. I mean, there's so many clinics around. I just don't know who's what and what's where. If you have that information, I'd like to have it. Secondly, I would like to hear an expression generally from the Deputy Commissioner and the Director. How well do you think you are tasked, are staffed, equipped to handle and manage this transformation? I know that the Mental Health Trust has offered to kick in some money to help manage some elements, but this is a pretty, again, parallel track. You'll have to do all the work you've been doing, plus staff transformation. I want to hear if you think you can do it or not.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, yes, I think we can do it. It is going to be a heavy lift. It is going to be a significant transformation. That is the goal here, to significantly transform the behavioral health system in Alaska. And so we know that those resources are limited, but we also know that we need to do it. And so there's a lot of enthusiasm and motivation to do this on the part of staff and providers. And so, yes, I believe we can do this, and we need to do it. And so, we're very much ready to take the next steps in this process.
Good. One last question, Representative Sadler.
One little one, the Figueroa rule again. Just to clarify, does the Indian Health Service provide behavioral health services? I'd heard some problem that the people that about 40% of those that qualify for Medicaid in Alaska are also IHS qualified. I just wanted to make sure that we don't set up a system where 40% of our people might not even go to the behavioral health system that we're trying to set up. But again, does IHS provide behavioral health? Sufficient?
Representative Sandler, through the chair, yes. All of the tribal health organizations have behavioral health divisions and provide significant behavioral health services.
Well, thank you, my chairman. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Munoz.
Thank you. On the points made by Representative Sadler, I just wanted to follow up for clarification on the family and marital counselor, the coverage with Medicaid for those services. Does the counselor have to be associated with a drug and alcohol treatment center or an outpatient mental health clinic in order to bill for those services? Can the counselor be a standalone operation? And the reason I ask is I've specifically had that question, and I'd like to have clarity for the record. Thank you.
Representing the note, through the chair, currently, yes, they do have to be associated with a clinic that's managed by a physician. They could not individually provide those services and bill Medicaid. They certainly can bill private insurance or accept payment, but if they're billing Medicaid currently, they would have to be within a physician clinic.
So for clarification, though, I heard Ms. Burkhart say that Medicaid would now be provided for those services. If you could clarify the distinction, please.
So this is Kate Burkhart. I was referring to SB 74, the provisions in SB 74 that remove the language in the statute that require you to be a grantee, and only community behavioral health centers managed by, well, with medical directors that are physicians, are grantees. Sorry. If 74 passed with that language, then a licensed mental health professional would be able to bill Medicaid for behavioral health clinic services, which are both mental health and substance abuse. So as long as they were practicing within the scope of their licensure, they would be able to do that if SB 74 passed with those two sections in it.
So again, that would an individual knows. Marital counselor would be able to bill directly to Medicaid. Is that true?
If the bill passed with that language in it. Yes, ma'am. Okay. Through the chair.
Okay.
All right. We're going to have you up next. Do you want to answer that question?
Through the chair, I'd like to make a clarification.
If you could, please, and then we'll move on to the next presenters.
Thank you. Just to clarify, section...
Put yourself on the record, please.
For the record, my name is John Sherwood, Deputy Commissioner of Health and Social Services. Section 33 addresses clinic services, and by federal definition, clinic services must be supervised by a physician. Rehabilitative services don't have that requirement. That's what's addressed in 34, Section 34. So I did want to make that clarification that still for clinic services, the definition of a clinic service is a service that's provided in a facility supervised by a physician or a dentist. So,
Mr.
Representative Munoz.
But a rehabilitative service would include family and marital counseling?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, yes, rehabilitative services are not defined in a way that would restrict it to an entity overseen by a physician.
Thank you.
Thank you, and I want to thank Ms. Forrest, Mr. Burns, and Ms. Burkhart very much for your presentations. Next, we'll hear testimony on the section on federal overview, waivers, and options. And first, we're going to take a five-minute brief at ease. All right, we're back on the record. Next, we'll hear testimony on the section on federal overview, waivers, and options. Here to testify from the Department of Health and Social Services, Commissioner Valerie Davidson, Deputy Commissioner John Sherwood, and Dwayne Mays, the Division Director for Senior and Disability Services. We have also online Margaret Brody for questions from the Director of the Division of Health Care Services. We're going to hold questions again till the end of the testimony, so we'll start with Commissioner Davidson, if you want to please start.
Oyana, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Valerie Davidson, Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. This morning, I am prepared to speak about Section 38 in the bill on page 37, which is the federal policy on tribal Medicaid reimbursement. Deputy Commissioner Sherwood will then speak about broad demonstration and waiver authority, as well as options, and then we will drill down into some specifics on the 1915 I and K options that are included in the bill by Director Dwayne Mays and Shane Spots. I realize we have some rhyming names going on, but if you'll just bear with us, I apologize. So really briefly, I'm going to try and keep this tribal Medicaid policy, and it's not what is up on the screen. That's just cued so that we're ready to move efficiently when Director Mays speaks. We have spoken about the 100% federal match policy, the CMS tribal policy, at several finance hearings before. However, this portion of the hearing today is to just provide you with an update on recent developments. So historically, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services has allowed states, or CMS, has allowed states to claim 100% federal match for Medicaid services provided to Indian Health Service beneficiaries or IHS beneficiaries under certain circumstances. And while they're a little bit more complicated, I'm going to just drill it down to about three just for simplicity's sake. First, the person has to be an IHS beneficiary, Indian Health Service beneficiary, and that means Alaska Native or American Indian like me. Second, the person has to be enrolled in Medicaid. And third, the care must be provided through an IHS facility, Indian Health Service facility. And I use the quote, which my youngest daughter used to call bunny ears, through a tribally operated facility. And I use that quote quite intentionally because CMS, or the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, has construed those words to be very narrow in the past. And they construed through the IHS facility as within the four walls of that facility. Unfortunately, what that meant was that medically necessary travel and accommodation services, which we know are an issue in our state that is geographically quite large with not very many roads connecting many of our communities, as well as care that was referred outside of the IHS facility or a tribally operated facility like we have in Alaska, the state was not able to claim 100% federal match. And so last year, Governor Walker asked Secretary Burwell to consider an 1115 waiver that would allow for 100% federal match to apply in two circumstances, the ones I just described. One is for medically necessary travel and accommodation services, and then two, care that was provided in a non-IHS facility or non-tribally operated facility, but that was a referral from an IHS or tribally operated facility. And Secretary Burwell indicated that they would be willing to change national policy rather than require an 1115 waiver, which is helpful for us. CMS issued a request for comment and then recently issued a state health official letter providing additional guidance to states regarding reimbursement services on February 26, 2016. And I believe you've seen a copy of this. And in a nutshell, CMS, or the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, changed national policy to do what we asked for, which is, one, to provide 100% federal match for medically necessary travel and accommodation services and for referrals from IHS to non-IHS facilities as long as certain conditions are met. I think originally, as you may have recalled through the budget process, we anticipated that that we were going to achieve about $12.5 million in savings in FY17, but quite frankly, thanks to the generosity of this committee and the new positions that were added, we estimate in FY17 we will save $32 million in general fund, increasing in the year fiscal year 2022 about $92 million. This section in the bill on page 37 in section 38, lines 2 through 19, require the department to collaborate with tribal health and the federal government to implement the policy, and require the department to report the estimated savings and require the department to fully implement that policy within 6 months. I was asked earlier if I would translate this. I think it doesn't have page numbers. Thank you.
While you're looking there, I'm going to follow up on what you just stated because I would like to get it on the record correctly. You talked about IHS travel, and you said that there would be 100% federal match, which means that the feds would pay 50%, state 50%, because that's the way you stated it, is a match of I want to make sure I got that on the record right.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, if I was unclear. Under our Medicaid program, because it is both federally and state authorized, the federal government pays a portion and the state pays a portion. The federal government's portion is called FMAP, or the Federal Medical Assistance Percentage, and typically it's called the federal match. And for regular Medicaid, it's 50% match, so 50% federal and 50% state. But for the kinds of services that I was describing through this tribal policy change, it is 100% federal match. So 100% federal, 100% 0% state, yes.
Okay. Continue. I'm sorry for interrupting.
No, it's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in a nutshell, I will go really quickly through this letter. I'm going to just skip right to the juicy stuff, which is found on page 3 in the letter. Permitting a wider scope of service, you can see at the top of page 3, indicates that the wider scope of service through an IHS facility means referrals to non-IHS facilities that started in an IHS facility, and then travel and accommodations. Toward the bottom of that same page, line 3, and if you look in the italicized sections, it says Medicaid beneficiary and IHS tribal facility participation is voluntary. CMS is just making it clear that freedom of choice must be maintained. And for folks who are looking for it, it looks like this. I apologize. Page 4 of the bill, I'm sorry, of the letter on the next page, the services must be done through a written care coordination agreement. And in a nutshell, it requires several things. One is both the IHS provider and the receiving facility that's not an IHS provider must both be Medicaid providers. So you can't have an IHS provider refer to a non-Medicaid provider and expect for the state to get 100% federal reimbursement. They both have to be Medicaid providers. They also have to have an established relationship between the IHS beneficiary and the IHS provider. So, for example, let's pretend that I'm a Medicaid beneficiary. We all know I'm already an IHS provider. I'm sorry, IHS beneficiary because I'm an Alaska Native or American Indian. I have to already have a relationship with an IHS provider, which of course makes sense because you can't refer from an IHS provider to a non-IHS provider if you don't have a relationship in the beginning to that IHS provider. And then the third requirement is there must be a written care coordination agreement. And in a nutshell, it requires the IHS facility or a tribal facility in our state to maintain responsibility for my care And also, that facility must maintain control over the medical record. So has to be able to maintain that control over the medical record so that information can be shared back appropriately. Also, there are no self-referrals, so I can't decide, hey, I'm going to go be seen in another facility. I actually could because I have freedom of choice, but if the state wants to be able to get 100% federal match for that care, it has to be a referral from an IHS facility. The other piece in this long section on page 4 and 5 is the form of the agreement between the IHS facility and the non-IHS facility can be flexible. They're open to whether it's a memorandum of understanding, whatever kind of legal structure that they're interested in. CMS has said they're willing to have that kind of flexibility. On page 5 in the italicized section that says Medicaid billing and payments to non-IHS slash tribal providers, this just basically all of those words mean that we have flexibility. Either the non-tribal facility can bill the state Medicaid program or the tribal facility can bill the Medicaid program for those referrals that happen. Page 6, more juicy stuff on managed care. This also just says that for states that do managed care, the 100% applies for managed care organizations as long as certain conditions are met. And typically, it's that the non-IHS provider is a network provider, which is standard for managed care organizations. They are paid consistent with the contractual agreement. And then the last one, number 5, is that they've met the managed care organization requirements under federal law. I realize I'm saying this is kind of simple, but for folks who aren't necessarily immersed in healthcare, I realize I may be speaking a completely different language. So I apologize if I'm not being specifically, if I'm not being clear. The same page on page 6, compliance and documentation, which continues on to page 7, are those basically list out the requirements for the states. 36 states are eligible who provide services, including Alaska, are eligible to be able to implement this policy, and it has some pretty strict requirements for what we have to do. Basically, we have to provide audit-proof documentation that, yes, all of those conditions have been met. The next section, which is actually pretty short on page 7, applicability to section 1115 demonstrations. This is actually a really helpful one for us, along with the next section, relationship between 100% federal match for tribal services and other federal matching rates. What these two sections basically say is if there's another program that has a lower federal match, this 100% federal policy with regard to tribal claiming supersedes that. So if all of these conditions are met in the policy, the state can claim 100% federal match, even if the other rules normally are is that's less than 100% federal match. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably more than you may have bargained for, Mr. Chair.
We'll continue on with the presentation. Mr. Sherwood, are you next?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm John Sherwood, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services. And I'm going to talk briefly about some of the federal Medicaid authorities for restructuring Medicaid health care delivery or payment. And we did provide the committee a handout that looks something like this. The highlighting in it is mine, so you won't see yellow on the front. But that goes through the authorities. And I just, in the interest of time, want to kind of hit the high points here. The first description is of the demonstration waiver, the 1115 demonstration waiver, and I think the first question most people ask is, why do we call these things waivers? And waiver authority under the federal Medicaid program really means that the federal government has the ability to waive certain federal provisions that would normally apply to Medicaid. There's three big ones and numerous lesser ones. The three big ones are state wideness. that a service must be available statewide. The second one is comparability of service, which means that people have to all have access to the exact same services. And the third is freedom of choice, which means that people get to choose their own providers. And generally speaking, the different waiver authorities allow you to waive one or more of those and possibly some other requirements. The 1115 demonstration waiver is the broadest waiver authority. It actually extends beyond Medicaid. If you wanted to, you could have Medicaid and Medicare demonstrations, or Medicaid and TANF demonstrations, or just a TANF demonstration. But it it really allows states to test policy innovations likely to further the objectives of the Medicaid program. It's granted for up to 5 years and then must be renewed, and typically, unless you do something different, they won't let you renew them in perpetuity. But the state of Arizona has operated its entire Medicaid program under an 1115 waiver, evolving over the last, slightly less than 40 years. They started in the late 70s. They were the last state to do a program. They have always been a managed care program from the start, and they've kept their 1115 demonstration going through that whole time. I think Director Burns mentioned a couple key features when he was talking about one of the specific ones in this bill, which is that you have to have a demonstration hypothesis that has to be evaluated with data resulting from the demonstration. So there are requirements to collect data, do evaluation, assessment, and it must be budget neutral for the federal government, not necessarily to the Medicaid program as a whole, but to the federal government. Federal spending is limited, and in some states actually sort of negotiate a federal cap to federal participation if they're really looking to do something innovative and want to give it a try. And in this bill, Section 30 on pages 29 and 30, Sections E and F are the two demonstration waivers. One is for behavioral health, and the other one is for an innovative payment model. So the next thing I wanted to talk about was the health homes option, which is Section 1945 of the Social Security Act. It's on it's in Section 30 on page 29 under Section D3. And a health home is really a look at care management, primary care, and acute behavioral health, long-term services and supports for individuals with chronic illnesses. It's kind of primary care case management or a patient-centered medical home on steroids, if you will. It's really it's really a beefed-up version of care management for individuals. It to qualify, individuals have to have at least two chronic conditions, one chronic condition, or be at risk of another, or a serious and persistent mental health condition. States do have the choice to select the chronic conditions to be addressed. Participation must be voluntary and allow choice of providers. There is an incentive for states to start this in that you might not see the savings right away, so the federal government provides 90% federal fund for the actual health home payments for the first 8 quarters that the state plan amendment is in effect. And then states implementing the health home must take part in an impact assessment, which would involve survey and independent evaluation of the program. So I'm going to move and talk briefly about our home and community-based services waivers and options, one which we already have in our program, and two which Director Mays will talk more about, but I thought it would be helpful to give a brief overview. Historically, when Medicaid started, long-term care meant institutionalization, and over the years, different alternatives to institutionalization and long-term supports have been provided under the Medicaid program. The oldest is the 1915C Home and Community-Based Waiver Program. That's the program we currently have right now. We operate four waivers for different populations. This must be an alternative to an institutional setting, so people have to meet an institutional level of care. They have to be offered the choice of institutional services or the waivered services. They are waivers renewable for five-year periods. They must demonstrate cost neutrality, but cost neutrality to the Medicaid program as a whole, not to the federal government. And they must specify the maximum number of participants for each waiver year and the criteria for selecting the entrants. You can waive statewideness, and they essentially automatically waive comparability of care, but without some other provision done at the same time, you can't waive freedom of choice under these waivers. And then two options that are in this bill that are similar to the waiver but have differences are the Section 1915I home and community-based services option. That's also in Section 30 on page 29, and that's Section D1 of that provision. And that allows states to offer optional state plan services, home and community-based services. Participants do not have to meet an institutional level of care, but they do have to meet specific needs-based eligibility criteria. So if you will, if they have to pass some kind of functional assessment. There is no cost neutrality requirement, and you can't have waiting lists or limits in the number of participants. Can target specific populations with different sets of services. So it's not entirely open-ended, but I think Director Mays will talk a little more about some of the issues around designing this to make sure you have a cost-effective program. The final home and community-based choice I'm going to talk about is Section 1915K, the Community First Choice option. That's another option for states to provide home and community-based attendance services and supports for individuals. Like the waiver, individuals in this option have to meet an institutional level of care to receive these services. And it can cover assistance with a wide variety of services that assist with activities of daily living, and instrumental activities of daily living. I think we are looking primarily at personal care services. And as an incentive to states to select this option, states are provided a 6 percentage point increase in the federal matching payments for services under these options. So this is, in fact, something that does enhance the federal match rate if we take it. And by way of background, the state already has as a state plan option personal care services in its coverage. So we're already making these services available to individuals in the program without issues of cost neutrality or limitations on the number of individuals served. And that is Section 30, page 29, Section D2. So the remainder of the document just briefly discussed some of the other managed care authorities, both waivers and options in the federal statute. They are not specifically cited in the bill. It is conceivable that some of the proposed projects could touch on those. Basically, there's different ways you can do managed care. Some are voluntary. Some you can actually mandate participation in managed care. And this goes through the different options, three primary options. And then the last two are really things you can do in combination with your 1915C home and community-based waivers if you want to do managed care with your home and community-based waivers. But since they're not mentioned in the bill, I'm not going to spend much any time talking about them. And that's my presentation.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Sherwood. We're going to move on to Dwayne Mays, the Division Director for Senior and Disability Services, and he is going to present what's on the screen for us. Mr. Mays.
Okay. For the record, my name is Dwayne Mays, and I'm the Division Director for Senior and Disability Services. This presentation that you have in front of you, we have a contractor Health Management Associates, Shane Spotts, online. So he's going to walk you through this presentation. Then after that, there's a few more slides breaking down specifically the numbers in terms of refinancing some of our general fund grant programs with the 1915 I option. So I'll walk you through that piece, and then we'll take questions. So I'm hoping he's still there, because I know that he...
It's been a long time.
Yeah.
Mr. Spotts, are you still online?
I'm here. Yes, Dwayne.
Yes, go ahead and place yourself on the record, and we'll begin.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Shane Spotts. I am a principal out of Indianapolis with the firm Health Management Associates. I'm working with Director Mays and his staff at Senior and Disability Services on developing an implementation plan for 1915I and 1915K Medicaid home and community-based state plan options. So just give you a quick background and a couple of numbers real fast on the programs we're looking at. So starting with the third slide on 1915K, Community First Choice, Deputy Commissioner Sherwood gave you some background, but a little bit more for you here. The 1915K option became a new option in 2012 to provide home and community-based attendant services and supports. The eligibility criteria for this option, very similar to the 1915C waivers that Deputy Commissioner Sherwood spoke to. So you must meet the functional eligibility equal to an institutional level of care, and you must, of course, be Medicaid eligible. As long as these eligibility criteria are met, the benefits are available to all Alaskans regardless of age or diagnosis. As Deputy Commissioner Sherwood alluded to, under the state plan option, the federal government contributes more money than they do to the traditional Medicaid program. So they contribute 56% of the match instead of 50%. In simpler terms, for those listening, for every dollar you spend in Medicaid, instead of the federal government contributing 50 cents and Alaska contributing 50 cents, the federal government will contribute 56 cents and Alaska will contribute 44 cents. And then within this program, relative to consumer direction, the state may choose an agency model at their discretion. So, again, as Deputy Commissioner Sherwood alluded to, the primary service that we're looking at for this option is the personal care attendant state plan benefit. Just to provide some perspective on that, it's already a state plan option in Alaska, so therefore it can be accessed by anyone eligible for Medicaid. Under the K, it would continue to be a state plan benefit. What we could do is shift the benefit of this service to the K for those individuals that meet institutional level of care and receive the higher match on that, and then the State Alaska program would be at really no risk of increasing the cost that they would have, whether it was on K or not. So for some financial perspective, current spend on the PCA program in Alaska is just over $85 million. Of that, just shy of half of it is expenditures by individuals currently being served on one of those 1915C waivers, where you have to meet that institutional level of care. So that equates to about 1,600 individuals. So then another 3,300 not receiving a waiver or receiving PCA services. So it would be those 1,600 individuals that would receive the services under the K. The 1915I is another home and community-based state plan option. So this is another option that provides consumer-directed home and community-based attendant supports and services. A couple key differences here really are you do not have to meet the institutional level of care threshold, and in fact, threshold has to be something lower than institutional level of care that's required on the 1915K option. You do have to be Medicaid eligible, and under the I, as Deputy Commissioner Sherwood alluded to, you can target specific populations for your I options. And when we say eye options, you can have multiple target populations under an eye. So you can effectively create sub-eyes under the eye option, for lack of a better term. And it's the traditional Medicaid match rate, which is 50% federal, 50% state in Alaska. In looking at the eye option, we're looking at sort of shifting funds from state-only services to the Medicaid program to receive that federal match. Listed here on slide number 7 are the number of individuals on each of the general fund programs. So the general relief program, approximately 349 of the 545 recipients would be eligible under the 1959 program as we're contemplating it. Under the adult day grants, 114 of the 423 recipients would be eligible. The senior in-home grants, about 123 of the 1,371 recipients would be eligible. The community developmental disability grants, we estimate that all of the individuals would be eligible. And the estimated savings of the shift of these programs to 1959 would be approximately $8.5 million. So through our project with Senior and Disability Services, there are some target dates here. So our implementation plan is due on July 31st of this year, so 4 months from now. And then the subsequent steps after that would be, included in the implementation plan, which would include the submittal of the state plan to CMS, the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, the approval of the state plan options, and then the implementation of these programs. So that is a kind of a very quick, in the interest of time, walkthrough of the options and some of the impacts of them. And I'll turn it back to Director Mays.
Thank you, Mr. Spotts. We're now going to move to questions from the committee for Mr. Spotts, for Mr. Mays, for Deputy Commissioner Sherwood, and Commissioner Davidson. Questions from the committee. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. To Mr. Spotts, just your last, through the chair, your last target dates slide, just give me some estimation of how long you think it will take for CMS to approve the 1915 I waivers. I've heard it can be as short as a few months or as long as 3 years. What's your estimate?
Yeah, I mean, I think I heard that point earlier. I think for the 1115 waivers, that's true. They're much more complex waiver submissions and a lot more negotiation with the state, with the federal government. I think for the I option, you're looking at a few months, 3 to 6 months time negotiation with the federal government.
Okay. And guys, one more question.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. A question that came up in a different context for the 1915K, that offers the incentive of an extra 6% on the FMAP, but what about for the Medicaid expansion population who will be offered 100% sliding down to 90%? Would they get the higher FMAP under 1915K for the Medicaid expansion population?
Yes. Go ahead, Deputy Commissioner Short.
Representative Sadler, it's a 6% enhanced FMAP, so most people would get the 50% would be the default. But if you have a higher match rate, you should get the enhanced 6% up to 100%. Obviously, we wouldn't get it in excess of 100%. But
so to clarify,
Representative Sadler, so want to clarify
if,
that?
Yeah, so I think I understand that you say that if somebody was a beneficiary under the expanded population, they would receive whatever the FMAP in effect at that year, plus an enhanced 6% up to 100%.
That's my understanding. Mr. Spotts may be able to confirm that if he knows something different.
No, I concur with you, Deputy Commissioner Sherwood.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler?
That's it.
No other questions? Sure. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 7, or page 8, just page 7, where it says estimated savings of shift to 1915I. Is that a shift from a different Medicaid waiver program, or is that a shift, just the shift onto the Medicaid waiver program?
Through the chair, it's a shift to the Medicaid program from a state-only funded program today. So you're paying 100% state dollars for these services today, and these savings would occur from receiving the federal matching percentage of shifting those individuals to the Medicaid program.
Thank you. And through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
I certainly have no objection to leveraging additional federal money. There's another 1915 waiver that requires that you, I mean, we essentially save money by treating people at home or letting people live at home instead of in an institution. And that was one of the original 1915 waivers. But the 1915I doesn't require that you meet that level of being an institutional level of care. So what is the requirement to receive the 1915I?
Through the chair. So what the federal government here is trying to do is it's still a home and community-based option, so the services have to be provided in someone's home or out in the community. What the federal government's doing is really lowering that institutional level of care threshold to give the states more flexibility to serve. It really is intended to fill the gap of some underserved populations. So you have individuals being served on state-only programs now because they don't meet that institutional level of care, where they are otherwise Medicaid eligible, but they can't receive those in-home services because you have to meet that institutional level of care. So it's lowering that threshold to make those services eligible for those individuals that are having some unmet need through the Medicaid program.
Thank you. Just finally, this is for the commissioner. Just there was some question as to why the department hadn't done a lot of this stuff earlier. The 1915I and the 1115 waivers that we've talked about today, are these waivers that have been around for a long time, or are these new waivers, relatively new waivers?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, the 1115 waiver authority has actually been around for some time. The 1915 I and K options, those two are not waivers, they're options, have only been around for a few years.
All right, thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, two clarifying questions. Mr. Sherwood, I wasn't quite clear whether I hadn't quite glommed onto the fact that these 1115 waiver options have to get renewed after 5 years. It wasn't clear if you thought that the five-year renewal would be a slam dunk or would not be. You cited, I think, Colorado or Arizona.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the 1115 demonstration waivers, because they are demonstration waivers, are required to demonstrate something, and CMS historically has not let you just continue to demonstrate the same thing in perpetuity. So states have operated some 1115 waivers for a long time, but typically as they come up for renewal, they make program adjustments to them, just as any program would evolve over time probably. So it has, as I said, the state of Arizona has operated their entire program under an 1115 waiver since their inception in the late 70s. But at some point, if you want to just keep doing the same thing over and over again, CMS may have an issue with that. I don't think it's really an insurmountable barrier for states that want to go in this direction and continue to operate. If you are doing the analysis you're required to do, you should be finding out what's working and what's not working and making adjustments and looking to make enhancements to it over time. With the other waivers, like the 1915C waiver, that is not a demonstration waiver. There is no barrier to renewing that repeatedly in essentially in perpetuity, since it's not really required to demonstrate anything. It's just offering an alternative to the traditional form of care.
Thank you. Follow up?
Representative Sadler.
So I think I hear you saying, correct me if I'm wrong, that if you go through the 1915 demonstration and demonstrate your hypothesis correct, that it's cost neutral to the federal government, you're able to provide services, at, you know, blah, 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 then you can assume that that will be implemented as a permanent situation, or does it go away after 5 years? That's what I need to get to.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, it would have to be renewed at the end of 5 years, and you would have to have an 1115 demonstration waiver must be renewed at the end of 5 years, and you would have to have a justification for renewing it. It may, and in some cases, this has been the case. By the time you come to the end of your 1115 waiver, federal policy has changed based on the information gained in that and similar waivers, that you're no longer required to use that specific authority. There's now another federal authority to offer those provisions. I think if you look at most of the managed care waivers and options, they probably evolved out of 1115 demonstration projects and the lesson learned to create more conventional options that weren't limited to demonstration.
Representative Sadler.
Follow-up, yes. So I don't quite know how to probe here, but my concern is that we go into the demonstration waiver application, obtain that approval, do it for 5 years, and for whatever reason are not allowed to renew it or the new policies don't allow. I'm just concerned that we find ourselves in a situation having taken responsibility for a segment of the population, we will be required under a lowercase maintenance of effort standard to keep providing services for them in the absence of the enhanced FMAP. We'd get under the waiver. Is that a fair assessment of risk, or is that am I being paranoid?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I think it's a legitimate concern. You are required under 1115 demonstration waivers. Part of the waiver is a transition plan. So, should you terminate the waiver or CMS terminate the waiver, how are you going to take people off the waiver and shut down whatever services they've been receiving that they can't receive under the regular Medicaid program? So that's part of the planning process. It's done up front what a shutdown looks like.
Okay. And last question?
Last question, Representative Sadler.
I would ask you if any state has had their waiver not renewed, but I think it's probably new enough, the INK, that there's not an answer. So my question would be, could a new CMS director or a new Secretary of Health and Human Services withdraw approval for a waiver? Is that something that there's a contractual basis for 5 years at least, if there's new administration, a new CMS director?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, my understanding is that if you are complying with the terms of your waiver, they cannot withdraw it prior to the five-year period.
I see Mr. Randall shaking his head yes. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Seeing Representative Wilson.
Followed by Representative Garrett.
I just wanted to follow up that, Mr. Chairman, I think the question was, though, if the waiver was done, you've done your performance, you see that it's working, and can they force you to keep doing it, and if so, is it back to 100% state funding? Does it stay at 56-44, 50-50? Where does it go once the demonstration is done? And the government says you got to continue to do it.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, just a point of clarification. The only one that really is not able to be renewed essentially automatically is the 1115 demonstration project. If they if the federal government determines that they're not going to renew the 1115 demonstration waiver, then you are not obligated to provide those services. You are not required to spend state money on services that wouldn't otherwise be covered in Medicaid. There is, as I said, a transition plan, and generally that is around ensuring that people get informed of the changes that are happening and be made aware of other alternatives either within the regular Medicaid program or within other programs that might be appropriate for people in their situation.
Follow up.
Representative Wilson.
But I think the whole point is that this doesn't exist except through state dollars. That's why we're paying state dollars for the program now. You can't transition forever. You already said that. So if the program was going to continue, would it fall under – the demonstration is not happening anymore. You're not asking for any kind of waivers, exemptions, whatever they are. would they automatically fall underneath the Medicaid program because you've been doing it? Or is it, like you said, if we, the state, decide we want to continue just because we see a reason for doing it, it would automatically go back to 100% state again?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the one that would, where renewal would be an issue, would just be the demonstration waivers. The 1915 I and K options don't have that same requirement that you demonstrate something. So in those cases, if for whatever reason the state were to decide not to continue an option, then in the case of K, you would have personal care services revert to its regular match rate of 50% instead of 56%. In the case of 1915 I, that would be as this statute is written, a legislative decision, and it would be a legislative decision whether they wanted to fund the grant, go back to funding the grant programs that were previously providing those services. With the 1115 demonstration waiver, there is no obligation for the state to continue paying for services in the demonstration waiver that wouldn't otherwise be covered under our regular Medicaid program.
I give.
Representative Guerra.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I've had this question all along. Mr. Sherwood, you addressed managed care. And I've heard a number of physicians say they've come up here because basically they can charge more. They've said we don't have managed care up here. Is managed care barred in the private sector? And is it barred in the private sector, I guess, in Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, not that I'm aware of. That's regulated through the Division of Insurance. I believe we have statutes that make provisions for it.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Guerra. All right. It looks like we're through with our questions for right now. I want to thank Mr. Spotts, Director. Oh, you're going to have this presentation now, Director Mays?
Yes.
Go right ahead.
Again, for the record, my name is Dwayne Mays, Director for Senior Disability Services. You've kind of seen in Mr. Spotts' presentation, these slides just kind of break it down specific to the different general fund programs that we want to refinance through the 1915I. So, and I could go through these, but I think you already know, so for the sake of time, I won't do that. And so I've been anxious to comment.
Good. And go right ahead.
So there are 19, I think, now I heard just the other day, 20 states that have implemented 1915I throughout the country. And it started back in 2007, I believe, originally with the Deficit Reduction Act, and then updated under the Affordable Health Care Act. So 19 states that have 1915I. There are five states, and I'll have Mr. Spotts correct me, but I know four for sure, and one I think just they now have the 1915K option, so that's in place. In talking to our contractor, he did state that in the very beginning of time with 1915K, you know, the first state to move forward with that, it took some time, but just for the benefit of Representative Sadler, we're looking at anywhere from 3 to 6 months to get approval. So if we do all the work, we create the infrastructure, we're moving forward with having a conversation with CMS, I would be comfortable in saying that it's going to be about 6 months before that happens. So with that, with the 1915K option, CMS requires that we have a developmental council, an implementation council. And so we put that in place. We call it the Inclusive Community Choices Council. It's 11 voting members that are actually recipients that receive services. So they're the ones that have voting rights. You know, they're there as advisors. They're not there to dictate where we're going to go, but we take their recommendations and their feedback. That council has been in place since November, and so we've had one face-to-face all day gathering, but every month by phone for at least 3 hours. So 11 voting members of recipients that actually are receiving services and or family members of recipients that are receiving services. Our advisors, we have 8 advisory associations are there, and then we call upon them after we make sure that the voting members have a say first. So that council's in place. That's a requirement of moving forward with exploring the design of the 1915K option. So those are the slides. I think I won't go through this because you can figure that out. And it was actually buried in Mr. Sponsor's presentation. So the contract, I think the last piece I will tell you is that the contract will end at the end of July of 2016. There's 11 deliverables within that contract. We're on target. We're on time. In July, what we'll receive from the contractor is a development plan. So it's a draft plan. Once they turn that over to us, then they leave, and it's up to us to then move forward with all the steps that we have to go through in terms of working with CMS to get approval for this option and so forth. So the implementation plan draft will be given to us in July of 2016.
All right. Further questions? Representative Wilson.
So just one, Mr. Chair. So could you just, and maybe I missed it somewhere, are these just additions that we added, you know, into the regular Medicaid, and that's why they're 100% funded? How do the actual program that now we're going to these waivers, where do they come from?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, if I understand your question, and stop me if I'm off track here. So we're refinancing all of our general fund programs with the 1915 I option, right. So we can draw down a 50% federal match. We're taking those services that exist within the 1915 C waiver, and these individuals then who meet institutional level care will move over to receive PCA services with an additional 6% federal match. So it's not, I want to be very clear, we're not growing the program. So the 1915 C waiver, when I see that being reduced, not going away, but being reduced, then I would see the 1915K option growing, if we get that approval, growing in terms of service delivery. So we're not, the goal of this is to make sure that we actualize reductions, not increases.
And follow up?
Representative Wilson.
So is the C waivers, and I'm sorry, we're really trying to follow all this.
Yeah.
But is the C waiver, is that the volunteer, the additions that we put on the 19 extra programs that we do that Medicaid doesn't require, but we've chosen statute-wise to do? I'm just trying to figure out where the $11,635,000, where did that actual program come from? I understand we're refinancing it, but how did we get it in the first place?
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that slide up there of the $11.6 million is pure general fund dollars, and there's a line item in the Division of Senior Disability Services for that funding that's been there for several years.
But where did the Mr. Chair, where did that program come from? I understand it's in the budget, but where did that line item, that when did we as a legislature decide that we wanted that particular program? Was it by statute? Was it something that the department decided was a good idea and we've just been funding it? Where did it exactly come, those programs come from that we're now refinancing?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I'm going to go with a lifeline, somebody who's been here for at least 20 years.
Thank you.
Or more.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, those programs are in statute, and they exist going back at least to the 1980s, possibly before, prior to the development of the home and community-based waiver system. So there have been grant programs providing home and community-based services for people with developmental disabilities for many, many years. I can't tell you exactly when they started, but since I got here, so to the department, which was over 25 years ago. So.
And Mr. Chairman, one final.
Representative Wilson.
I'm sorry, I went home and North Pole English got back into my system again. So, but the, so they're by statute, so they're really not connected to Medicaid at all, except now were able to use a waiver system that's come about to be able to pay for part of those programs. But they're just in statute because somebody decided they were a good idea. We've been funding them with general funds, and now we have an option of using one of these waivers to continue the program, but only have half the money going general funds and the other half federal, or 56-40 for whatever.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I think I would pretty much agree with what you just said. The state also historically, with statehood, one of the duties it assumed was taking over the role of providing for people with developmental disabilities who, prior to statehood, had been sent out to Oregon. And they did that both by building a facility in Valdez Harborview, but also by funding these grant programs for those who didn't need to be in the institutional environment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just getting confused with the optional programs. Now, these are obviously not optional. They're just something that started somewhere else. So thank you.
All right. I want to thank everybody. Mr. Spotts, thank you. Director Mays, thank you. Deputy Commissioner Sherwood, thank you. And Commissioner, thank you very much for being here, Commissioner Davidson. Before we end, I want to ask if Senator Kelly's office has anything else to add. No, I see none. I want to thank everybody for lasting out this long meeting we've had today. All right, our next, we're going to set aside Senate Bill 74 at this time. Our next House Finance Committee meeting will be held on Tuesday morning, tomorrow, March 29th, at 8:30 a.m., and at that meeting we will continue to hear Senate Bill 74. The discussion will be assessment of Medicaid reform options report. This is the Menges report that we'll have up first that was generated by Legislative Budget and Audit. And then we'll have Medicaid Redesign and Expansion Technical Assistance Report by Agnew Beck, Health Management Associations. And with that, at 4:40 p.m., we are adjourned.